This episode of Retronauts is brought to you by Notion.
This week in Retronauts, what are you doing next? I'm gonna go to Outworld! Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to Retronauts, and welcome to this very exciting, very dangerous episode about Mortal Kombat. But not the first Mortal Kombat, because we did that. That was back in episode 447. That was an eternity ago. An Eternia ago? Hey, there's a reference for those combat fans out there.
I absolutely don't get it at all.
That's it. You're referring to Edenia. I think Eternia. Is that Masters of the Universe?
Oh, my God. Might be, yeah. There it is. What a way to make a joke that immediately be corrected. That's perfect. Anyway, my name is Diamond Fight. I know nothing about Mortal Kombat. Clearly, I'm just here for the clicks. But I've got two guests here, two expert guests. We're going to figure this out. Let's go first to the UK and our returning correspondent.
Hello, I'm the beloved Stuart Jip, and my favorite Mortal Kombat character is Man-E Faces.
Thank you, Stuart. And our other guest, I think, is in the United States?
Yes, that's correct. Northeast Ohio, the mecca of Mortal Kombat, but not really. I am David O. Craddock. I am the author of the Long Live Mortal Kombat series, and it has lived long. It's a little over 30 years as of October 2022, and I'm writing about the history of all the games.
And it's great. Just want to pitch in with that. It's really, really good.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah. I think I was on the Kickstarter, and I was loving it. It's great.
Okay.
We talked about it in the first episode as well, the Mortal Kombat 1 episode. Sorry, I'm not taking this over. You go over to you, Diamond.
That's all right. What you said wasn't completely true. There was a Kickstarter for his book. I assume the Kickstarter has ended because that was well over a year ago. Mm. And I don't think Kickstarters go more than like 2 months. But that's cool because what's happening today is we're talking about the sequels, the immediate sequels to Mortal Kombat. Because when Mortal Kombat hit in 1992, it was big. It became really big. Even though there are only 7 characters, it became a phenomenon. All those 7 characters became pretty famous. And there was even a date, September 13th, 1983, aka Mortal Monday, which was a rare early occasion where they were actually hyping a launch date for a video game, which didn't happen that often. Today, it's pretty normal. I mean, as we're recording this, you know, there's a video game upcoming later this week that everyone's very excited about. It's been years in the making. But back in the 90s, they didn't do that very often. So it was a big deal when Mortal Monday came around.
The only other one I can think of was November 24th, 1992, which was Sonic Tuesday.
Yes, yeah, that's another good example.
Yeah, those are the two biggies, I would say. It was still a rare occasion, right? And then I feel like Mortal Monday was the one that really put it on the map. A lot of other publishers were like, oh, this is a thing. We can do this. We can build hype around a date.
I would say so, because the Mortal Monday, like, the commercials were specifically about that day, and they filmed this, the ads were very famous because they were running around lower Manhattan, and I don't think I mentioned this last time, but I actually went to high school with one of the kids in that ad, and so after it came out, which was during our senior year, like, everyone would just shout Mortal Kombat at him, like, whenever possible in the halls, which is like...
Rightly so.
I mean, I don't know what he expected, but that's absolutely what he got. Anyway, but a funny thing happened just a few months after Mortal Monday. They made another Mortal Kombat, and they called it Mortal Kombat 2. So today we're going to pick up the conversation with Mortal Kombat 2, which arrived in late 1993, November, maybe December, depending where you live. Again, arcade games really didn't have, like, dates, so we're just, you know, we're working with, you know, spotty histories there. But we know it came out after the games were already out at home, and Mortal Kombat 2, in my opinion, really felt like a dramatic upgrade to the first game, even though it only came out about a year later. I feel like a lot changed in that year. Would you concur? A lot changed?
Yeah, absolutely. And in some ways, like, great and small. Like, the tech was a little better. So characters were, they moved much smoother, And one of the big changes that might not seem big right away, but that really opened the competitive community's eyes to Mortal Kombat 2, kind of taking it more seriously, was when you jumped over opponents, your character would twist to stay focused on them. So in the first game, if you did a flying kick over their head, you wouldn't turn around, which made you look like a sucker as soon as you hit the ground. But in this case, you actually could. So you could do things as you could in Street Fighter 2, kind of like float overs to kind of confuse them as to when and where to block and, you know, go for a really deep juggle combo, which is when you kind of wait until the last second to pull off your flying kick. And that way that pops them into the air right as you hit the ground. And you can just, you know, flow into some more moves from there to juggle them around.
Yes. I think even some characters, if you do a deep enough jump kick, you can just do another jump kick, right? You can like land and then do a quick one, I believe.
Yeah, there are. I mean, this brought into the fore, you know, a lot of corner strategies, which brought it closer to Street Fighter II. You know, by this time that had become kind of the standard bearer for the competitive community, like, you know, different strategies depending on where you stood and where your opponent stood relative to, you know, your positions on the screen. But also, I think that Mortal Kombat 2, it was still had a somewhat photorealistic look, still used digitized actors, but it had more of a comic book veneer. It was just so much more, so much more vibrant. So between the, you know, the changes to the mechanics of the game, the more vibrant veneer aesthetic, and then the smoother movement, this was really kind of where Mortal Kombat began for a lot of people.
I got to say as well that with Mortal Kombat 2, even before you put your money in the machine, you've got this really exciting attract mode going.
Oh, yeah.
Running around with the sort of really well-composed story scenes and Shao Kahn looking like an absolute, you know, beast that he is. And then those quick cuts of just violence, fast-paced violence. I think they really set it apart. And then, of course, you know, the lightning forming the big two and then the huge Mortal Kombat crashing in from the sides. I remember as a kid seeing that attract mode on a loop because I didn't have any money. So I would just watch that and just get increasingly hyped for it. Of course, when I did get to play it, it delivered. I think this is the, I don't know, it's kind of the Mortal Kombat game. Does that make sense? Like, it's the one that you can wholeheartedly recommend, I think. Not that there's anything wrong with necessarily the other ones. It's just that this, to me, is the most focused one. It's the least bloated, you know, everything seems to be there for a purpose, but it still has a lot of fun, additional things, gimmicks and gags and secrets to enjoy without being completely over the top like Mortal Kombat 3 was. But we'll get to that, obviously.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, this is the one where I think it has a lot of people's favorite roster, introducing so many fan favorites that are still fan favorites today. And it's really kind of the rare instance, except for the upgrades to the MK3 series, which again we'll talk about later, where the whole cast did carry over in a way. You know, Sonya and Kano weren't selectable, but they were visible on one of the backgrounds, which, to Stuart's point, really kind of drew fans into the lore. You wondered how they got captured. Could we free them? You know, the secrets around Mortal Kombat were really swirling around this time because of the fatalities, which were really considered a secret in the first game. You know, the if you heard about someone doing a fatality, that was something you had to see to believe. Like, you don't do that in video games. Video games are like Mario. But in Mortal Kombat 2, they really leaned into that. Even on the battle plan, you saw a question mark, so you knew there's at least one hidden fight there. At least one, but there were several more.
Yeah.
That's right. And in fact, if you don't do something special, your character just bypasses the question mark. So, like, probably the first time you play Mortal Kombat 2, you're like, what is this? And then you go past, you're like, wait, what was that? And then, you know, unless you know what to do, you don't get it.
I got to interject. The first time you play Mortal Kombat 2, you do not get to the question mark. I'm sorry.
No, definitely.
You get your ass beat.
That took a lot of quarters to get even half that far. But it was, I mean, some of the secret characters, which we can discuss, is, you know, they were so secret that even co-creator John Tobias did not know about them. This really kind of established Ed Boon's penchant for burying secrets so deeply that only he could find them without a treasure map.
Well, let's let's talk a little bit about what Stu mentioned with the attract mode and what things have changed, because they absolutely lean harder into their original storytelling and their original concept, and it takes, you know, bold steps away from the sort of, you know, bog standard Ender the Dragon that was the first game. Because, yeah, even if you don't put your money in this machine, it tells you that, guess what? Liu Kang, he won that Mortal Kombat tournament. He beat Goro. He beat Shang Tsung. And Shang Tsung went back to his master. There was a master, this guy named Shao Kahn. He looks very large. And he's the emperor of some place called Outworld. And he doesn't like this. He doesn't like losing. So what he decides... No. Yes.
Sorry, I don't mean to interject. I wanted to just say, this story stuff, for one thing, seems, for an arcade game, for a coin-op, seems deeply unusual to even bother including it. And secondarily... This may be post Mortal Kombat 2, so by all means correct me, but the comics that they were putting out, like about the Dao De Zan and stuff, and Goro, Prince of Pain, I think they were the place to kind of get this stuff before MK2. Am I wrong about that? The Malibu comics, I think, put them out, maybe?
Yeah, I think that was around the time of Mortal Kombat 2, but it does sort of predate that, because both Mortal Kombat 1 and 2, part of the attract mode was advertising a collector's edition comic that was, oh, yeah. I think it was, yeah, that was, they were advertised in later updates to both games. It wasn't there like from day one, but the funny thing is when I talked to John Tobias about this, I said, you know, like, it was very rare to put in attract modes that were more than just, you know, brief flashes of gameplay to kind of get you hyped. And, yeah. You know, I said, you know, some people would stand there just waiting to read character bios, waiting to see these just beautifully drawn story scenes. I asked him, like, did you and Ed want that? And he's like, well, it was always kind of a push and pull because even I, you know, John Tobias is kind of the, you know, he often receives credit as the brain behind Mortal Kombat's lore, but he and Ed were constantly passing ideas back and forth, just kicking things around. So he would say, you know, we both wanted people to put in their quarters, but I also kind of knew that, yeah, people might stand there and kind of maybe hope for no one else to be playing so they could just read as many character bios as possible.
I think that's really cool and forward thinking, honestly, because the fact that the story from these games has more or less carried through all the way to the modern day, even with an in-universe kind of reboot. I think that's real interesting and forward-thinking that they did that, basically. And the fact that they had these tie-in comics at all. I know Street Fighter had story as well, but God knows what it was. I have no idea. Mortal Kombat could tell you a lot, but not Street Fighter.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Like, around this time, from about 1991 through 1994, Capcom was just iterating on the same game. And Street Fighter 2, no question that it was revolutionary, but...
Oh, yeah.
I think I made this joke maybe here, but I did on a lot of podcasts. Like, the most lore you were going to get out of a Street Fighter 2 attract screen was, like, learning Ryu's blood type or something. It wasn't really captivating, right? But, like, the interesting thing, when you beat Mortal Kombat 1, you saw these different endings, and you're like, oh, so... which of these endings is true? Because they can't all be the champions of Mortal Kombat. But then you go into Mortal Kombat 2, and right away from the attract mode, you realize Liu Kang's the champion. But what else could have happened? And it's established the endings as these are not what happened. These are what if scenarios. What if this character won? And there were certain things like when you beat the game as Sub-Zero, you realize, oh, this isn't even the same Sub-Zero from Mortal Kombat. Scorpion killed him. And this is Sub-Zero's younger brother. So you were establishing these familial relationships. There were new rivalries. You know, Sonya and Kano were both abducted. So probably just like spitting at each other from across Shao Kahn's arena. But you had Liu Kang really after the Tarkatan Baraka's race, which, it's hard to remember this, but the Tarkatan weren't even named in Mortal Kombat 2. It was just like, oh, a bunch of Barakas sort of thing. But there are all these new little wrinkles in the lore, and it was just so, so fascinating. And in fact, there are a lot of people who really miss this style of storytelling where you were kind of, it's almost like a Dark Souls game where you kind of...
Thank you for bringing up Dark Souls, David.
I have to make a Dark Souls reference. Everything is like Dark Souls these days. I'm just carrying it forward, right? But like, you know, how do these pieces of lore connect? Whereas today in the modern Mortal Kombat games, the cinematic, they're playable movies and they're very well done. They're very fun, but there's really no... there aren't as many questions to be asked because everything is spelled out for you. And that's really not as interesting even to me, as these arcade games, because I mean, I was the guy downloading like 40 to 60 page MK FAQs and reading them behind my Trapper Keeper math class. Like, okay, what's the lore? What's the speculation? What's the backstory? I wanted to connect all these pieces, much like one would do playing a Dark Souls game.
I had a collection of those comics I mentioned that I don't know where I got it from, falling to pieces, because I read it so much. It wasn't even good, but I loved it. Just the sheer magnetism of the characters that they've designed. Like, they really are appealing and interesting. And that's something, for me personally, I can't say about almost any other fighting game. Maybe some of the King of Fighters stuff, but I can't even begin to tell you what the story is in those games.
No, and I feel like that's probably almost intentional, because for a long time, a lot of fighting games were just Street Fighter clones, and they were clones in almost every way, like aesthetically, but also like story. Who cares? It's just a bunch of fighters in a tournament. It was John Tobias and Ed Boon going like, here's where Scorpion hangs his mask sort of things, like really wanting to give you more insight into the characters. And they weren't really thinking about this at the time, because all arcade game manufacturers were just heads down on one project and boom, onto the next. But they were slowly building what would become, during Mortal Kombat 2, a just consumer multimedia empire.
Well, as I was saying, part of this new story initiative is the idea that you have this emperor and he's lived somewhere in your outworld, and somehow he decides that, well, we're just going to host the next tournament. So we're going to, now the Mortal Kombat takes place in Outworld. And what this does is it gives the game an excuse to sort of redesign the world, if you will. So because we're not in our world anymore, we're in this Outworld, this other place. So all the levels look nothing like the last game. Everything looks weird. There's like, there's monstrous stuff. There's weird stuff. There's also, I mean, Outworld as a place is, you know, they get to make it up. So I really enjoy the variety of stages you see, you know, even in something simple as like the pit 2, which is, again, it is like, it's a big pit, right? But they have this weird like background where you see another bridge behind your bridge, and there's people there. And like, I know for us as children, we were always like, who's on that bridge? What are those figures back there? What does that mean? Just, you know, are those extra fighters? Can we go back there? You know, people told me stories you could go back there, or people would come back to the front. Like, they're all fake. But little things like that really went a long way to sort of building not just the lore they had in mind, but letting the players sort of make up their own lore. And, at that point, it's all valid until you hear otherwise.
Well, they were fake at the time, and then in later games, some of that stuff became true, almost as a kind of an Easter egg for the fans. I know the living forest trees eating players was a thing, was like a rumor that they eventually put into, what's it called, Shaolin Monks on the PS2. They added that in, and in the newest game, in Mortal Kombat 11, you can go to the second bridge in the background of the pit.
Perfect.
As a little, and that's something that I think helps to create that connection between the community and the developers, you know, so you feel like it's for you, even though it's this Warner Brothers multi-million corporate thing, you feel like it's for you. And I think Mortal Kombat has always done a relatively good job of that, even when it was in its kind of wilderness and making stuff like Special Forces. I think they still did a decent job. It's what connects me to Mortal Kombat, really, because I'm terrible at Mortal Kombat, but I love the characters and I love the world and I love all the silly things about it. But every time I play it, I just get destroyed, you know?
Yeah, I mean, just to your point, It was really interesting to compare and contrast how Mortal Kombat and Street Fighter kind of positioned their stages. Like, Street Fighter 2 stages were sort of representative of the character to whom the background belonged. You know, like, you fought Chun-Li in a Chinese marketplace. You fought Ryu in a studio that was very Spartan and almost monastic, because he was just so concentrated on improving and growing. Whereas Mortal Kombat stages and Mortal Kombat 2s, they are, every stage is a piece of a world, and you're seeing how this all comes together. And the island was like that, but the island's environments were much less interesting. It was like the courtyard and the courtyard with monks in it sort of thing.
Yeah.
And it, now here, as you said, you have, you know, a living forest where characters are peeking out from behind trees. You have the pit too, where, you know, there's this character fighting in the background. You have this portal with monks guarding it, and you're wondering, like, can I go through that portal? And it turns out you can in a way. Every stage offered something, whether it was a stage fatality or a little tease as to, you know, what it meant for the lore. It was world building is really the term we would use now.
It is something that's been to some extent lost with the advent of the internet, or at least the popular internet, because you can just look this stuff up. But back then, of course, this was all changing hands in the playground. You know, this was all like, oh, I heard you can be reptile in this game, or no, sorry, he's not hidden in this, but you know, you can be, God, who are the hidden characters in 2? Crap, it's escaped me completely.
So Jade, Smoke, Jade, right? It's Jade and Noob Saibot.
Yeah, yes. It's like, yeah, if you press this when the toasty guy is on the screen, you get to fight Smoke. If you do this with through one round, you get to fight Jade. It's like, it's lore. It's playground lore. That's just what it is. And I love the fact that they lead into that in this way, including red herrings, things that ultimately do mean nothing at the time.
Yeah, like everything kind of means something. And it went even deeper than that. Like, you not only you had to fight Smoke by, I think it was holding down and pressing your start button, but only in multiplayer and only on the portal stage. And so it was almost, was kind of another layer of competition, because the player, if you both knew that input, whoever inputted it first was the one who got to face Smoke and get ruthlessly murdered by a grossly unfair AI. You know, it was a privilege.
I don't need to tell you this, folks, but life is already complicated enough. And on top of that, you have to work for a living? What's up with that? And if your line of work involves being on the dang computer all day, you know how hard it can be to track tasks, set goals, all while trying to spend as little time as possible switching tabs and sorting docs. But never fear, that's where Notion comes in. Today, I'm excited to share that they just launched Notion Projects, which includes new, powerful ways to manage projects and leverage the power of built-in AI features, too. Notion Projects combines project management with your docs, knowledge base, and AI, so you can stop jumping between tools and stop paying too much for them, too. In just one workspace, you can do everything you need to get your projects over the finish line, from brainstorming to drafting launch plans to organizing sprints and keeping everyone on deadline. Notion is super customizable too. View projects any which way, as a timeline, table, or Kanban board. There's also powerful filtering and automation features so you can work exactly the way you want. And on top of that, Notion AI helps you automate all that tedious overhead like summarizing meeting notes or finding next steps, freeing you up to do the deep work. Do your most efficient work with Notion Projects. You can try it for free today at Notion.com/retro. That's all lowercase letters, Notion.com/retro. When you use our link, you're supporting our show. Go right now to Notion.com/retro.
Well, let's dive into the roster, because there are quite a few changes here. First of all, they've expanded significantly. You know, the first game had seven fighters. This new game has 12. And most of the fighters from the first game carry over. Notably, yes, Kano and Sonya did not make it. Supposedly, the story I've always heard is that those two were just the two least popular of the original seven. So they said, okay, well, we won't use them anymore.
There's a little bit of clarification on that. And I asked about that, too. Like, you know, today, games can, you know, send all sorts of statistics over servers. You can find out anything you want about your game. Sonya and Kano were the least popular in the arcades that Ed and John pulled around Chicago. They could go into the debug mode and look at the least selected, but elsewhere, like the DOS manual for the PC port, the DOS port of Mortal Kombat 1 listed Sonya as one of the most popular characters. And in terms of the tier list, she is by far and away the strongest character in the game, to the point where she is broken. in some versions. So it just depended back then. Like, you know, things were so different. It just depended on, this was the local data that they had, and they just kind of had to apply it on a global scale for the roster.
But certainly Liu Kang is there because he's the winner of the first tournament. So he comes back, and I do like the fact that they've changed. I mean, everyone's outfit has changed, you know, to some degree, but I like that they've altered him so he doesn't just look like a regular Bruce Lee type. He's got some color to him, which I want to point out, in that first game, there was a lot of just plain, very simple color palette. Like, a lot of characters just wore black or gray. And, you know, aside from, you know, Sub-Zero and Scorpion, there wasn't that much color there. And so when you had, like, a mirror match of, you know, one character fighting the same character, you fought, like, a slightly darker version of the same character, and they looked almost identical. And I really feel like they must have learned that. They must have learned that was a mistake, because every character in this game and going forward, they've got some kind of bright color on their body that can be palette swapped and reversed for player two. You know?
It's much more vivid and much more appealing to look at, I think. And as was mentioned, I forget who said it, so I apologize, but it does have a much more comic book aesthetic as a result. It doesn't lose some realism, but it's just, it pops, you know. It looks great in the arcade. It stands out.
Mm-hmm. So Liu Kang has like a headband and like a stripe on his pants that can be changed. You know, the colors can change. Johnny's got, I think, something on his boots, or like he's got like black pants, but he's got like some knee pads or something. So everyone has something on their body that can be flopped, or at least changed in tone. Like Sub-Zero and Scorpion are still going to be the blue guy and the yellow guy, but because the colors are so brighter and bolder, you can see the difference this time around. It's not subtle as it was in Mortal Kombat 1. It was almost too subtle.
Yeah, to the point where I don't remember if this was only in the Super Nintendo version, because that's the version I played exponentially more than in the arcade. But Kitana, who's my favorite character, had a silver outfit instead of blue. And just because of the rarity of the silver outfit, you know, it only came up in a mirror match and always for player two, I always preferred that outfit.
Yes. We'll get to Kitana in a second. But yes, as part of this redesign, Liu Kang also, I have to point out, this is the first game that gives him his now infamous bicycle kick, where you have to hold down the button and then he launches himself forward in an impossible manner and he just kicks over and over and over again.
I thought that was in one. Am I completely mistaken on that? I could have sworn that was
Diamond's
in the first
game. That was two.
Wow. Okay, that's really weird. I have a false memory, a Mandela effect, of me playing the SNES port of the first game and doing that move, but obviously I didn't.
It's a very famous attack, but this is where it started. Yeah. Also, very significantly, is that, you know, he has his fatality from the first one carries over, but he has a new one where he turns into a dragon, which I think raised a lot of questions at the time. Like, wait, he can just turn into a dragon? You know, why don't you leave with that moment, brother? But whatever. It looks cool as hell. Like, it's very much, you know, it's still, this is 1983. So morphing is still a big deal. You know, when you morph something, I think, oh geez, Michael Jackson's Black and White, I think was that 92 or 93? Was it 91, was it? No.
Oh, gosh.
No, I think it was 93. I think you're right there. And the cool thing about the dragon was that it was more storytelling. Liu Kang was the only character in Mortal Kombat 1 who, when he performed a fatality, the screen didn't darken.
Right.
But in Mortal Kombat 2, he's more out for, he's almost on a quest for revenge because all of his fellow monks were slaughtered. So the screen darkens when he does his cartwheel kick, and he turns into the dragon, which is, of course, the symbol of the Mortal Kombat tournament. He is Mortal Kombat. It's kind of cool.
It was 91, by the way.
Back away. Oh, 91. Wow.
Yeah, earlier than I thought as well.
Well, anyway,
the dragon morph is the inspiration behind the animalities, right? I mean, it's got to be.
I would say so. Which
I
we'll
would
get
say,
to.
Yeah.
Well, impossible to do.
So, Johnny Cage is back. He's got a new outfit. He's no longer just Bloodsport Jean-Claude Van Damme. They threw in a weird alternate version of his fatality where you can just enter a different code and he punches your head off three times. I guess because in the first game, if you were fast enough, you could punch off two heads, right?
Yes.
I think that's the joke there.
Yep.
So it is a gag and not a glitch.
It was a glitch in one and a gag in two.
Yeah. Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah, it's like a special, it's a different command than the regular command. It's like, you know, you have to do it intentionally. Raiden has a makeover. Somehow he's a good guy now. The first game he was very much a bad guy, but now he's a good guy. He's supposedly the protector of Earthrealm. I don't know what it's called, but to me, I always viewed his new outfit as he's wearing a new smock. He's just got like, this little blue kindergarten thing on top of his regular outfit, which just looks kind of cute.
This was prior to the first movie, but it would have been in production, right? Am I wrong there?
It's 93? I don't know if they're actually shooting at this point.
Right. I just wondered if it was to do with the movie that he was now a good guy, as you know, has changed for the film. But it doesn't really. I'm probably wrong. It's just a coincidence, maybe.
I think the movie takes elements from 2 and 3, because 3 was, you know, 3 actually comes out the same year as the movie. So I think when they're making the movie, they have a lot more lore to work with, and they start, you know, pulling that stuff together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's correct. I mean, I think that, you know, this was just, you know, they did the first game, which was pretty much, you know, John and Ed's kind of Enter the Dragon, but a video game and with ninjas. And then, you know, with Mortal Kombat 2, they were like, let's rethink, let's kind of establish some of these characters. And they kind of, you know, had Raiden pick a side, basically.
Yeah.
Good for him. I want to say he joined the winning team, but I guess depending on the reality, he didn't win the team.
I don't know. I mean, Raiden now is kind of the good guy who screws everything up all the time, and everyone wants him to just stop. You know,
he's pretty temperamental for an elder god. It's a poor quality for when you're as powerful as he is, I think.
Yeah, everyone's just like, thanks for the Armageddon, mate. Thanks for that. Cheers, Raiden.
So let's talk about Sub-Zero, because Sub-Zero is back. He was always one of the most popular characters. And they threw in a new move where you can throw ice on the ground, which I always liked to use, even though I felt it was very rarely, like, useful. I just thought it was funny. And yes, as David alluded to earlier, if you beat the game with Sub-Zero, the ending actually shows his face. Now, it's not the actor Daniel Pacino who played him in the first game and the second game again, but they actually went to a then-recent Midway hire, a young man named Joshua Tsui. And they said, look, we want him to be Asian. You're Asian here. And literally, as we have a quote from him, which says, the joke back then was anytime they needed an Asian dude at Midway, it turned out to be me. But Josh would run with that because he would eventually become the Liu Kang model in Mortal Kombat 4. And just a few years ago, he directed an entire documentary about Midway called Insert Coin. So Josh really, you know, went from, hey, we need you to take a picture, to I'm deep involved in this project, and hopefully I'm loving it.
Even then, it shows the fluidity of development. Like for Mortal Kombat 3, you know, Sub-Zero Unmasked was played by a white guy named John Turk. So, you know, I did ask John Tobias about this. He said, yeah, we were playing pretty fast and loose. You know, some parts of the lore stuck, others we were just kind of playing around, changing here and there.
Yes, honestly, we can go on a big tangent because, yeah, later games have established the actual names of the original Sub-Zero and the Sub-Zero younger, and how the first Sub-Zero became another character. But I don't want to get into all that. It actually is legit fascinating to me, but I don't want to get into it right now because it's a gigantic discussion, because these characters, you know, have deep and intertwined lives.
Yeah, and there are some fans who just played for that reason, right? Like, they just wanted to really dig deep into that.
Speaking of which, Scorpion is back. Scorpion hasn't changed that much, although I do like, as a little detail, they erase his pupils, so he looks more sort of like ghostly, which I think is a nice touch. And Reptile graduates from secret character to regular character, and he's just, you know, he's basically a green Sub-Zero, but they give him a new thing where he can pull off his mask, like his face, not his like mask, but his entire head is actually a mask, and underneath he's got like a lizard head. And he can eat your head with his head. And he can also turn invisible. And there's a fatality where he turns invisible and he kills you. What does he do? I don't know. He's invisible. You can't see him.
I love that. Reptile has got to be the Mortal Kombat character who's gone through the most drastic physical appearance changes throughout the series. Like, he's gone from a sort of human with a reptile head to just like a full-on feral, like, reptile creature in later games. And then he's kind of gone back to being a ninja again. It's kind of funny.
Yeah, there's a lot of debate among fans about which version of Reptile is, you know, the best, where, you know, you have a masked ninja at one end of the spectrum and then total feral reptile with a really long tail at the other. I kind of fall somewhere in between, but I actually look forward to seeing not only if Reptile will be in every new game, but just what form he'll take, because I love seeing it fluctuate over time.
That's cool.
So we mentioned that Kano was on the outs, but that didn't mean they didn't like Richard DiVizio. No, they brought him back and they said, okay, look, we want to give you this sort of Nosferatu mask, and you're going to be a weird guy from Outworld. We're going to put knives in your arms. You're going to stab people. It's going to be great. So he's playing a new character called Baraka, and he's one of the Outworld like regulars. So he's like appearance alone, you can tell this guy is, you know, kind of messed up. He's got these swords. I always felt that one of, you know, he has one of the more graphic fatalities, but it's also one of the more silly ones where he just stabs you and you just sort of bleed. But it looks, it's kind of horrifying, but it's also kind of funny because you slowly slide down his knives and like it just stops. Like you kind of wonder, like, what does he do next? Does he pull you off? Like, does someone help him? Like, because otherwise he just got a dead body on his arms. Like, what does he do?
That's why the screen fades. He's like, look away. This is going to, I got to actually like
put my foot on this.
Kiss this. Yeah. Kick this guy off. And I think this was, you bring up a great point, which is, this was the last Mortal Kombat where the fatalities could be somewhat grounded. Like, you know, Baraka's two fatalities are one, he just slices your head off, into the other, he just kind of lets you bleed to death on these knives. There were some explosions and things of that nature, but it got really out of hand later on.
Which we will talk about once we get to the next game. But for now, he's, I would say, most fatalities are cool in some way, and he's definitely got some of the more primal ones. Because he just has knives in his arms. What are you going to do? Indeed, he has a move that's not even a fatality that just looks really painful, which is that sort of anti-air slashing move that, like, if he does that, you can't jump into him, you can't really touch him. And, you know, he swings his arm around for a few seconds, and it's like, if you get too close to him, you just get slashed up and blood flies everywhere.
It's like, okay, Melina, I'm going to stand here and I'm going to be doing this. And if you get stabbed, it's your own fault. It's just that Simpsons bit. Sorry, I had to.
And indeed, if you're playing the AI, it can do that, you know, in an instant. If you jump at the computer and it's Baraka, he just does that move. It's like, okay, well, you made a mistake. Talk about this this newcomer. I believe it's Caitlin Zamiar. She is the new actor. She's playing Kitana and Melina, Kitana's twin sister. They are, of course, palette swapped ladies. And Catalin. I'm sorry, I didn't look this up. I think it's Catalin or Caitlin. Anyway,
it is Catalin. Yeah,
she was a graduate student. She was a forensic science instructor. She had an anthropology degree, but of course, she also practiced karate and Okinawan martial arts. She was recruited by Daniel Pacini to be in the game. Kitana is a really deep lore character. She's invested in a lot of stuff. I think it's no surprise that she shows up in the first movie that comes out a couple years later, because she's connected to a lot of characters and has a very important role. In this game, you don't really get a sense of how important she is. She just seems like a cool person because she has big fans. She throws the fans. She swings the fans. She has one move where she spins her fans around and she lifts you off the ground. And if you do that move at the wrong time or to the wrong character, you can outright freeze the game.
Is that something that got patched out?
I believe it did get patched out eventually. But yeah, Kitana, I mean, between her fan lift and her fan throw, which I think is the goriest, or the second goriest non-fatality special move in the game, right after Baraka's like knife slice attack. Mm. She's just kind of built to juggle people to death. Most of her combos are maybe three hits, sometimes four, and you can kiss half your life bar goodbye.
Yeah, she's one of those characters who can jump, kick, and then just throw a projectile, and that'll hit you too. And if she does it right, she can maybe do something else, or like do something else into the jump kick and then throw the thing. So it's, yeah, she can do a lot of damage in a short amount of time. And if she has a stun move, then she gets a free combo. So yeah, she has a lot of potential. And I must say, her twin sister, Melina, I always found her very hard to control, just because all her moves were like charge, but not like a guile move. It's like you literally hold the button down and let them go, which I found very complicated and hard to use. But of course, the computer doesn't do that, so the computer can just hit you whatever it wants.
So it's actually, it's just one move, the side toss. But to your point, you do kind of always want to be holding high punch, because if anyone jumps at you, you just pop up, release that button, and they're going to be back on the ground. And the others, you know, her roll and her teleport kick were just regular inputs, but because she can break out most of those moves at the drop of a hat, especially if you're, you know, almost perpetually charging the Psytos, she is the top tier in the game. She is a monster, if you know, played in the right hands.
But you chose your words well, David, because she is literally a monster. When
she is literally
when you see
monster.
Her pull the mask down, she's got like a Baraka face. So it's like, it's very clever. And again, we're not getting to it, but there's a huge story reason as to why she looks like Katana, but she's not actually a twin. She's some sort of like genetic experiment slash monster baby. Whatever.
I feel like with Mortal Kombat 1, you know, Boone and Tobias has started this trend with Scorpion of, hey, what if a character takes off their face and there's something else? And in this game, you know, Melina takes off a face and Reptile takes off a face. And it's just like, what are these people really? It's just another kind of layer of mystique and intrigue around fatalities and characters and who and what they really are. It was pretty cool.
I do like the fact that Melina can take off her mask and just basically inhale you and then spit out your bones. That's a nice fatality.
Not as bloody as you would think, just a big old pile of bones.
Well, you know what? She doesn't waste, you know? She takes
very
it all.
Efficient. Yes. That's
she
right.
eats your clothes. She even eats your clothes. Speaking of clothes, let's talk about Kung Lao. Kung Lao is a character that's actually referenced in the first game in the text of the Attract mode, but you didn't get to see him. He was a legendary warrior who defeated Goryeo centuries ago. But now he's here, and what you're playing as is a Kung Lao who's a descendant of that Kung Lao, played by a man named Anthony Marquez. And you brought this up last time, David, but he was supposed to be in Mortal Kombat 1 because he was part of this crew, this clique of martial artists. But he was like hurt, or just he was unavailable, and he couldn't be in Mortal Kombat 1. But like, okay, Mortal Kombat 2, you're in, dude. You're in Kung Lao. You're Kung Lao now, and we're giving you a real badass hat. And we're giving you the coolest fatality in the entire game, okay? And he said, okay.
Yeah, he could have gone down as maybe the ninjas and Kung Lao, but Kung Lao absolutely has my favorite fatality in MK2. The slice where you just cut you in half and you fall over and like do a almost like a banana peel split when you hit the ground is just awesome.
I gotta say, I would like it more if he didn't do the pose with his arms out after he did it. What? Because that's why I prefer the hat decapitation, because when he catches the hat, he just stands there like a badass. The split is good. Kung Lao is probably my favorite character in this game. He's just too cool looking not to like. He's got too many cool moves as well. Like, getting around with this guy is an absolute breeze, to be honest. I mean, you still get absolutely destroyed, but you can teleport, you can do that spinny thing, which is like a zoning thing. You can throw projectiles high, low, you know, he's really good. He's a great character. And yeah, he just looks really cool. So I like him a lot. He's one of my favorite Mortal Kombat characters, period.
Yeah, really his pose where he's kind of showboating is an aspect of his character they leaned into later. He's kind of the Ken to Liu Kang's Ryu. You know, Liu Kang is laser focused, deadly serious, and Kung Lao has an ego and some attitude.
I know it's slightly off topic, but in the much more recent Mortal Kombat movie, I did enjoy Kung Lao appearing there, and they let him do something with his hat that was absolutely disgusting.
I mean, in Mortal Kombat, God, I want to say X, he's got the most horrific fatality where he throws the hat down and it stays there like a buzzsaw.
Yeah, that's in the movie.
And then he grabs you by the legs and is that what he does?
Yep.
Almost. I think it's similar, but yeah, his hat's in place and he like rides someone into it in the movie. But,
yeah, it's like groin first, just in half. It's vile.
Yeah, that's Mortal Kombat 9, which does have.
Oh, it's 9. Okay.
I bring it up because there are other fatalities in that game. We won't have to get into all of them, but like that is the game that probably has made me wince more than any other Mortal Kombat game, where the fatalities actually look really painful and not just over the top.
Oh, speaking of painful fatalities, let's talk about Jax. Jax is a character who, again, might have been him in the first game. They had a character in mind called Striker, but Striker eventually morphed into Jax. And there's a funny story behind this. So Jax is the first black character. He's played by a man named John Parrish, with two R's, by the way.
Okay.
No relation to Jeremy. And John Parrish was a weightlifter and a bodybuilder, ex-military guy. he was a trainer in the club where Daniel Pacina and all those guys were worked out. And apparently, because he was, you know, in with all these guys, he was playing Mortal Kombat 1 when, you know, early on. And he pointed out, I was like, hey, there's no black people in your game. So he got the privilege of being the first black person in the game. The way they designed him, the way he looks, he just looks like a really strong guy. Like, his outfit is very simple, but he just looks like a really buff, strong dude. And both of his fatalities, I feel like, reflect that. He can crush your head, which I'm wondering, because this is 1993, given the fact that the people who make Mortal Kombat are all nerds, do you think at that point they've already seen the story of Ricky, which came out in, I want to say, 1990?
God, that's a good point.
because that famously has a man crush another man's head with his hands, and that's exactly what Jack says in this game.
I mean, probably, to be honest. Yeah, I mean,
it's possible.
Sorry, I apologize for this little brain fart, but he does have the metal arms in this game, right?
No.
That's three.
No,
that's three.
He doesn't. Okay, my bad. I apologize.
No, he is just a big man with big muscle arms, but he can rip your arms off, which in again, the other...
How ironic.
Really brutal fatality.
Yeah, one of my favorites, but also the one that makes me scratch my head the most, because... they don't really appear to die at the end. Like, they're left standing kind of in this expression of agony while blood spurts out of their arm stumps. But it's kind of like, yeah, that would really hurt. Are they dead? I guess we can be led to believe that they bled out after the screen faded.
Well, if it's 1993, then I want to say Time Killers is already on the market. And that is a game where you can lose both your arms and you get to keep fighting. So
it's weird that they keep fighting when they've after that's happened because they're completely armless.
Well, it's only a flesh wound. Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Thank you, Stu.
You're quite welcome.
In all seriousness, though, if you win the match without arms in Time Killer, I believe you get a big bonus.
Unfortunately, you're still playing Time Killers.
Let's talk about Shang Tsung, because Shang Tsung is now a playable character, but he's been given a complete makeover. He no longer looks like just like the old man from Big Trouble Little China. He is now a younger, not young, but younger, played by a actual medical doctor, a man named Philip An. Instead of Ho, because originally it was just Ho Sung Pak in old man makeup, but now they have this, you know, martial artist who's a doctor. Again, he knew everybody, so they didn't try very hard when they cast these games. Like, who do you know who's also into this stuff? Oh, you know this guy? He's a doctor? Great, let's have him come in and become Shang Tsung. So what I love about Shang Tsung in this game is he only really has one move. He can throw fireballs, which is what he did in the first game. But as a player, if you learn them, you know, it's all different moves if you learn them, he can transform into every other regular character in the game. And to me, this is like expert mode. Like, once you know all the characters in Mortal Kombat 2, you can play as Shang Tsung, and you can basically be everybody, and you can do weird combos where you turn into one guy and then do another move. And it's just, to me, it is so much fun to show off, especially when it comes to fatalities, because if you transform, you can do all the fatalities in the game.
Yeah.
So I would love to play this game, you know, against the computer, and, you know, once I got good at it enough, I would just go through it and I would just fatality, and just put on a show for anyone watching. And it was just so much fun. You know, the crowd would go wild because, you know, again, it's early on. Unless they've been hanging out in the arcades all the time, they probably haven't seen all these fatalities. So I just had a blast doing that kind of stuff.
I mean, he's got the most crowd pleasing fatality and one of the most difficult ones to pull off, which is the Kentaro morph, right? That's, I want to say hold high punch for 20 seconds. I might be wrong on that one.
I believe it's low punch.
I think it's low punch. But yeah, you have to hold
it.
You're basically holding it for like a round and a half. So if you can still manage to pull that off, like, skills, right? Mm. Respect.
I mean, he's great unless you're playing this on one of the CD ports like PS1, in which case it's the biggest pain in the butt imaginable because they have to do disc access every single time you transform.
loading is his second unique special move. I think that I would actually say that Shang Tsung can actually mix and match fatalities. One quirk of one of Sub-Zero's fatalities was that you had to first deep freeze the opponent before you could pull it off. And whereas normally you only had, I think, around like 2 seconds, maybe three to pull off a fatality, the deep freeze bought you a good like 5 or 6 seconds.
Yes.
And if you messed up the second part of the fatality, you could just keep deep freezing endlessly. Well, if you were Shang Tsung, you could morph into Sub-Zero, deep freeze them, keep doing that to kind of run the clock until you morph back to Shang Tsung, then morph back as someone else, and then do their fatality, which would cause the opponent, the frozen opponent, to sometimes glitch and just appears like a spectrum of colors, because you could go from like the deep freeze to like Kung Lao's, you know, hat slice or hat toss, any other fatality. So it's just kind of like a fun arcade crowd pleaser to mix and match fatalities that way.
Yeah, and the funny thing about that is the deep freeze move, which, and then he punches you to explode, basically, that is essentially a sort of more graphic version of what they came up with for Sub-Zero in the Super Nintendo version, you know?
Yes.
Which I thought was very funny.
Yeah, they definitely played to that.
They took what was the, you know, the bloodless, you know, censored, quote-unquote, version that the Nintendo fans got. It's like, okay, you want to break someone? Here you go. Now his guts come out.
Which shows that, like, the idea, even on Super Nintendo, was cool. It was just missing that Mortal Kombat flair, and it definitely had that in MK2.
Mm.
Oh, cool. I made a Sub-Zero pun. All right.
And I also want to reiterate one point is about Kato and Sonya, who are not in the game, but they're seen in the game. The bookkeeping screen actually had a counter that said Kano Transformations, which is a false hint. You cannot do that. But anyone who saw it believed you could, which helped people, you know, believe that you could. But it's a lie. You actually can't do that. But they put it in there to mess with people.
Which just shows you how deep this rabbit hole goes. Like, most consumers would not have any means of accessing that menu. But if they did, or if an arcade operator was curious, Boone snuck that in there. And that, combined with the fiery character in the Pit 2 background, I think that's Hornbuckle or whatever they ended up naming. I'm always confusing him with Hornswoggle in WWE, but I think it's Hornbuckle. And that was a trend where, you know, Boone would tease things that were not in the game. And that's something he would continue in Ultimate MK3, showing Rain in the teaser, and Rain was not in that game.
They actually created a completely fake character, put him in the interact mode, and it's just a lie. You can't, the character's not in the game. He would appear later in the game, but in that game, you can't play him. He's never there.
So the burning guy in the background of Pit 2 is not Blaze.
That might be Blaze, but I think you know what I'm thinking of? There is a palette swap of that character who is not on fire and who has green stripes on his leggings. I believe that's Hornswoggle.
That's Hornswoggle.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
The son of Vince McMahon. Okay.
That's right. That's right. And the anonymous Raw general manager.
Yeah.
I guess. Yeah.
But speaking of backgrounds, we should also mention that by putting their characters in the background, they basically reused footage they had shot from earlier in Mortal Kombat 1. And Elizabeth Malecki, who was Sonya in Mortal Kombat 1, didn't take kindly to the fact that her image was in Mortal Kombat 2, but she wasn't used in Mortal Kombat 2. And that'll come up later in this episode. Let's talk about those hidden characters, though. We mentioned them by name earlier. So Mortal Kombat 1 had Reptile. Not at first, but they put him in one of the revisions. So Mortal Kombat 2 has three hidden characters. There is Smoke, who is, I would just say, Gray Scorpion, except there's smoke coming off his body, like, just he's constantly smoking. Not like a cigarette, like, his body is literally smoking.
Has to be uncomfortable.
You would think so, unless, I assume it's coming from him and not his clothes, but I'm sure lore masters know the answer for that. As David mentioned earlier, the only way to fight him is to press down and start on the portal stage when Dan Forden appears and says Toasty, which only happens some of the time. So it's a really rare occurrence.
And in multiplayer. Has to be multiplayer.
There's also Jade, who is basically Green Katana. She is a little easier, at least more predictable, because if you win one round using only low kick before that question mark stage, then you get to fight Jade. You go straight there. She's a little tricky to fight because she's immune to all projectiles, but once you know how to fight her, She's pretty to do. And indeed, if you pick the right character, you can even do a fatality as long as it only uses low kick. Which I think, oh, it was funny. Meanwhile, there's also the incredibly hidden, you know, to David's point earlier, I don't think, you know, when they put this character in the game, I don't think they told anyone else until it was already out there. The character called Noob Saibot. And yes, if you read that correctly, that is Boone and Tobias backwards. Noob Saibot. And the other joke is that he's basically a black ninja and that he is literally all black, which means he's very hard to see on the background.
Yeah.
But the only way to face him, which is, this is amazing, you have to win 50 matches in a row.
So is that loop, is that in versus or looping the arcade ladder or that got to be versus? I mean, no matter what, if it is versus, that's expensive, right? That's an expensive pursuit.
Yeah, it definitely had to be versus because I believe like the counter has to read 50 and it resets once you beat the game.
That's so,
yeah, incredibly expensive.
Very expensive.
I think I only faced him on Super Nintendo and that was just me beating, like plugging in two controllers and having the other player sit there for 50 matches and then fighting Noob Saibot.
And as mentioned earlier, he is one of those characters who has an incredible back history that we're just not going to get into, but believe it or not, this guy that was obviously created as a joke, was like, what if we just made a black ninja and what if we named it after ourselves? No. He's so much more than that. And I'll leave it to you to research that on your own because it is actually a funny story.
Well, let me touch on one aspect of his development history, which is a much shorter story. So after Mortal Kombat 1 and Reptile was added, John Tobias discovered Reptile along with everyone else because what happened is he had just given Boone some color palettes and said, here, if we need these, we can use them for the ninjas. So Boone created this green and black ninja. And John Tobias went to him afterwards, wasn't upset, but he just said, hey, if you tell me about these secret characters, I can write some lore for them. And Boone was like, oh, yeah, sure. No problem. Definitely will. So they collaborated on Smoke and Jade, but Noob Saibot was another Ed Boon prank that John Tobias later discovered. And, you know, Boone's little wink and nod was not only a secret character, but their names spelled backwards. So I just love that one of the co-creators had to discover this along with everyone else.
So this is a dumb question, but the purpose of fighting these characters presumably is just for a big score bonus, right? You must get a big bonus for beating these, or is it? I mean, I know it's for arcade, like, you know, for props or whatever. It's for like bragging rights, but you do get a bonus for fighting them, presumably.
That was another big change. Mortal Kombat 2 dispensed with the score; it was just a win counter.
Okay,
yeah,
there's no more points.
Yeah, I was thinking of remembering the first one, but yeah, that's it. Okay, that's interesting then. Yeah.
It was really more for, like, not only the arcade bragging rights, like you said, Stuart, but I think it was just Mortal Kombat to me is kind of the game embodiment of journey, not destination. Like, you find these characters and they completely wipe you out. But just discovering them or hearing about them and then finding them, it was just kind of gratifying to know that it was true. And it also got you more excited about what else could be hidden in this game.
Mm.
Right. For every real secret, I think we all imagined 10 fake secrets.
Yeah. Yes.
Not secret, but unplayable, are the two boss characters. First of all, they decided, okay, well, we liked Goro, but let's make a new Goro, and let's call him Kintaro, which is also a vaguely Japanese name. He's also tiger-striped. I believe officially he is Goro's dad, and he is just gigantic. It's like, if Goro was big, he is huge, massive, ginormous, just a beast.
He's cool as hell. I love him.
He's cool as hell. He's probably one of my favorite boss character. I just love the tiger stripe design. Yeah, so cool. And also really, this is where even more world building begins. So in Mortal Kombat 1, Endurance Match 3 always takes place in Goro's lair because you fight Goro next. And the screen during Endurance Match 3 would kind of shake and you'd hear something really big walking around above you. And then Goro would just drop down. In Mortal Kombat 2, when you fight Kintaro and Shao Kahn, you fight them in Khan's arena. And the crowd just goes nuts whenever Kentaro or Shao Kahn score a hit. Mm-hmm. And it's really like if the speakers are loud, you feel like you are in the middle of a gladiatorial arena and the crowd is just dead set against you. It was just a really, really cool touch that showed not only really great story building, but just Dan Forden's brilliance with the audio design of these games.
And since you mentioned him, let's talk about Shao Kahn. Shao Kahn is indeed the last boss of this game. He is a very large, muscular man, and he was played by a very large, muscular man, competitive bodybuilder Brian Glynn, who was apparently recommended by John Parrish. He doubles as the narrator of the game. You know, he's the guy saying fatality and finish him, but that's not Brian Glynn. That voice is by Steve Ritchie, who is a member of the staff. Shao Kahn also loves to mock you. He just, throughout the game, he will say things and insult you when you're fighting him. He points at you. He laughs at you. And he's got Steve Ritchie has a fantastic laugh. These are great evil laughs, I gotta say.
Yeah, I really love the narrator. Like, his work in Mortal Kombat 2 is probably my favorite. That's where we got a lot of stuff, like, outstanding. You just this booming voice. And I really always liked, you know, continuing the trend from Mortal Kombat 1, that you felt like someone was watching you and judging you the whole time. And then was going to go, you know, oh, okay, good job. And then, you know, step down from his throne and just kick your ass.
So, in carrying over the fatalities from the first game, Mortal Kombat 2 kind of just says, okay, what if we just did more of that? So, in Mortal Kombat 2, everyone has 2 fatalities now, except for Shang Tsung. Shang Tsung has 3 fatalities because that's just who he is. There are 3 stages where you can do special stage fatalities, but none of them are as simple as the first game where you just uppercut them off the ledge. No, you have to do a special command or hold a button down, and it's a secret thing where it's like you see the stage, you know you have to do something, but until you know how to do it, you can't do it. But the computer can do it to you very easily to let you know that you can do it, which is always funny. And I must say, I always thought that the Pit 2 was a huge improvement on the first one because, you know, the first one was definitely, you know, the first time you saw it, it was horrific. And it's like, oh, God, the spikes down there. But for the Pit 2, you get a special animation of your opponent just falling to their death. And, like, the camera changes position and they're falling onto a flat background and they hit the ground. And it's not exactly gross, but it is bloody. And I feel like it's very effective. It's like, oh, they fell and, oh, they're dead now. That's them. They're dead.
Yeah, I loved that camera change because this was around the time when 3D fighting games were starting to creep in. And it was just kind of a cool, like, pseudo 3D view that I think that's why people really remember that fatality. You really got the sense of the character falling and kind of like flailing around like, no, this is not going to be good. And then just that satisfying, like, crack when they hit. It wasn't over the top. In Mortal Kombat 3, they would have exploded into like 10 million skulls and rib cages. But in this, they just looked dead and broken, and it was really effective.
Absolutely. The Deadpool had a pit of acid. You can put them in the pit of acid, and then you turn into a skeleton, which I took.
It's such a cool sprite. I love it.
It is. And there's a way to make the narrator say something, but he doesn't say any words in English that I can recognize. It's just like a sound, like, I don't know what it means, but there's a way to make the narrator say that, which is just funny. And likewise, the stage, I didn't look up the name, but there's a stage with spikes in the ceiling, and you can hit them, you can uppercut your opponent into the spikes. And then I think if you pull down on the sticks, they will slide off the spikes very slowly and grunt when they hit the ground, which is just,
it's got both sticks. It's like an Easter egg. It's both sticks, right? You pull down on both sticks. I love that.
It's like
you're grabbing hold of them and pulling them down yourself. It's
Yeah, I always had to, like, as a kid, this was very important to me. I was never sure whether I wanted to make them slip off or not, because if they slipped off, they didn't, like, bleed all over the floor afterwards. And I really liked that. Also, I think the stage name was kind of appropriate. It was either the tomb or the combat tomb. And this was kind of a hidden thing as well, because while you were playing, you didn't see the spikes above. It was basically an inverted pit one, which was kind of another little Easter egg. Like, oh, there are spikes up there? Like, it was just another secret.
So is it just a matter of winning with an uppercut?
No, it's a command.
Okay, yeah, okay. That was always one thing that kind of disappointed me. Like, I kind of felt that, like, the pit one was cool because you could just win for an uppercut. So it was a great way to show people that, first of all, there was more to these stages than met the eye. Second, there were death moves in this game, even though it actually didn't count as a fatality. You didn't get bonus points or have the announcer say fatality.
Yeah. It's the easiest to pull off of all the fatalities.
The easiest to pull off. Yeah. So I never really liked the stage fatalities having different inputs, but... you know, it's been a thing ever since MK2.
I mean, compared to what's coming, it's really next to nothing in terms of excess, you know.
yeah.
But of course, you don't have to kill your opponent. You can do nice things for your opponent. There is two new finishers that do not kill. The first is the Babality, and it turns your opponent into a little crying baby. And they're all special, you know, individual sprites. They're all pretty cute, even Baraka with a big monster face. Though I do remember there was at least one revision of the game that got patched out at some point where you could do the Babality and then cancel your animation, and then you could actually attack the baby, and then it would, like, just explode into, like, a bloody mess. Not, you would actually see a baby, but, like, the baby sprite would disappear and blood would appear, so we just said, oh, we killed the baby. But, like, that's not what happened at all, but it just, it was a funny glitch.
That's a glitch, yeah. Okay, thank God.
Right. And even sillier, but also more elaborate, was the friendship, where you just do something nice or weird, or maybe you just dance. They vary wildly from character to character. I feel like the ninjas all use the exact same gag where they hold up a doll and they say, oh, buy a Sub-Zero doll, buy a Scorpion doll. I thought that was disappointing they all had the same one. But Kid Thunder's a great one. Raiden just makes a small version of himself and it says Kid Thunder, and that's just, it's just funny. It's just, I like that one.
And those were a little sort of dig in the ribs of the whole controversy, weren't they? It's like, look, we're not doing a fatality. We're doing nice things. It's fun. It's like sort of sardonic. I quite like it.
It's also the community kind of adopted it as a way to, just kind of in your face when they would beat you, because remember, like, you have to meet very specific conditions. There are certain buttons you can't use during the winning round.
Yes.
So if you get beaten by a Babality or friendship, it's kind of the other player's way of saying, I didn't even need all the buttons to beat you.
Yeah, it's like a humiliation. I like that.
Right. Well, it's as you said, Stu, that's what they called it in
Killer Instinct.
Killer Instinct, yes. Mm-hmm. Killer Instinct had the humiliation where you make your opponent dance, but this is just like you. They don't do anything. You do something, and they just sort of keep their dizzy animation and just no reaction while you laugh.
I thought it was nice they brought them back for 11, the fake friendships.
Yeah, I did too. Also, I have to say, Stu revealed his friendship at the top of this podcast when he complimented my book. That was Stu's friendship move. So I really
appreciate it. Yeah.
I assume, David, your friendship is signing copies of your book and then throwing them at us.
Yes, and free of charge. That's the friendly part.
You know? But unfortunately, when the book hits me, I turn into 10 skulls and die. That's what happens. That's what's going to happen with my book, because it's vast. You could use it as a murder weapon.
That should be on the back.
This book can be used as a murder weapon. The police. Not the band.
Retronauts is taking over Long Island Retro Gaming Expo. I mean, there'll be other non-Retronauts-affiliated people there too, but mostly, the show is all about Retronauts and Friends of Retronauts. On Friday, August 11th, you can come see me, Jeremy Parrish, talk about the history of Epoch game consoles with Kevin Bunch. That's Epoch, not Epic. And on Saturday, you can see the main Retronauts panel as I discuss the first decade of Metroidvania evolution with a whole slew of people in the main theater. Diamond Fight, Nadia Oxford, Kat Bailey, Jared Petty. I don't know how they're going to cram us all into the main stage, but it's going to happen. And I know that everyone in the main panel will be presenting other talks that weekend, including separate presentations by Jared and Diamond, as well as an Axe of the Blood God presentation by Nadia and Kat, with guest appearances by me and Diamond. What I'm saying is that if you like to hear Retronauts-related folks talk about old video games, you're going to want to attend Long Island Retro Gaming Expo at the Cradle of Aviation Museum in Long Island, New York, August 11th, 12th, and 13th. And when you're not attending our presentations, you can check out tons of amazing free-play retro games in an amazing museum in the coolest space ever devoted to retro gaming. Seriously, you should go. It's August 11th through 13th, and it's going to be rad.
But really, that's kind of Mortal Kombat 2, you know? As we said at the top, I feel like it's an incredible improvement on the first one. I feel like it exudes confidence in every way. It really shows a lot of growth. Mm-hmm. And really, you know, if you compare it to, you know, Street Fighter II launched in 1991, and Capcom basically kept making Street Fighter II until 1994, just making new versions of it. The fact that Mortal Kombat 1 came out in 92, and Mortal Kombat 2, with this much upgrade and change, came out a year later, to me, as an arcade goer at the time, I thought that really stood out as a dramatic contrast. Like, wow, mm-hmm. Street Fighter 2 has barely changed, but look at this brand new Mortal Kombat a year later. This is incredible. Like, I felt like I was the luckiest little kid in the world that I could just play this game.
It's easily one of the greatest sequels of all time. I mean, this was the game that, as you said, Diamond, really started to steal players away from Street Fighter 2. Because, you know, by this time, I think they were up to maybe Turbo, which is actually my favorite version of SF2. But that's kind of where it peaked. I was not interested in the other upgrades, whereas Mortal Kombat, they were adding numbers. You know, returning characters had new looks. There were new characters. There were new secrets. It gave you something to really look forward to and get excited about.
And the other thing that got excited about Mortal Kombat 2 is that when it came home, eventually, this was the game that Nintendo's like, okay, fine, whatever. We like money more than we like pretending that we're some kind of moral high ground. So go ahead. So if you bought Mortal Kombat 2 on Super Nintendo, you got to kill your opponent. All the blood is there. All the fatalities are there. You know, the sprites aren't quite as big. The sound isn't quite as good as the arcade. But I feel like otherwise, the Super Nintendo port of Mortal Kombat 2 is pretty faithful in that it lets you do all the stuff that the arcade version does.
It's a great port. I'm a Mega Drive guy, but it's great. The depth of color and everything is just superb. And the speed of it's great. It's a really impressive port, I think.
So, yeah, I completely agree. So for another book, Arcade Perfect, about arcade to home conversions, I talked to the one and only programmer who converted MK2 on Super Nintendo. And, you know, he felt like obviously, Sculptured Software had a lot of pressure because the Super Nintendo version of that first game, for myriad reasons, was not good. So when, Midway, you know, Williams Midway actually played it, they actually sent him a letter via fax, and he sent me a scan of it, where they actually congratulated him and said, this is like the definitive version of the game on 16-bit systems. The Mega Drive version did end up outselling it, probably because of the momentum from the first game, but there was a very clear winner here if you played them both.
So what is taking aside like the disk accessing problems and such, would the best home version technically be the PC version if you had a controller?
So, yeah, very specifically, Adam Clayton was the programmer. He was commended for the best 16-bit version. The best version overall, and I had this one too, was definitely the DOS version. I think the major change to it, I think the soundtrack was different because of different MIDIs. Yeah. But otherwise, in terms of graphics, sound effects, and, you know, no loading time for like morphs and things like that, that was the best version. The problem was back then, there were really wonky PC controllers. Like, there was no standard and there was no good one. Like, I didn't like the Gravis gamepad because the buttons were kind of sunken, so it was hard to hold two at once with your thumb, and there were only four, so you had to hold two for block. But, you know, playing on the keyboard, actually, a lot of pro MK players still play with the keyboard to this day, so I really like playing with the keyboard.
Yeah, with the numpad and such. You can buy that, I think, on GOG as well. I'm not sure if they've taken it down. But it was on GOG, yeah, along with Trilogy as well.
So, Stu, you said the magic word Trilogy. That means there is indeed Mortal Kombat 3. And it arrived in April of 1995. The movie, by the way, launched that August. So by the time this game comes out, people are already talking about the movie. People are already hyped the movie. Really, 1995, like all year long, was basically a stretch of Mortal Kombat hype in general. If you play the game, it says the movie's coming out soon, so they really were, you know, putting all their eggs together. It's like, here we go. You all wanted this. Here's the new Mortal Kombat game. Let's do this.
Yeah, the hype for this one was crazy. There's a commercial, like a magazine ad that's stuck in my head for all these years from EGM or something, which is literally just nothing. Nothing can prepare you. The repetition of nothing. Like, when I was a kid, I was like, well, this is obviously going to be the greatest thing ever produced by human hands. So, yeah. But that stuck with me big time.
Yes. So, building up off of 2 into 3, they've gone even further with the story. Again, you get another very dramatic attract mode with Mortal Kombat 3, giving you an entire story outline. So somehow, you know, despite all this outright cheating, Shao Kahn loses Mortal Kombat again, and he doesn't like it again. He's still unhappy with this.
It's like Dick Dastardly. Yeah.
So, and this is really weird, and I'm not going to explain this because I can't explain it. So he has a queen named Sindel, and she died like 10,000 years ago, but he has her resurrected on the Earth, which somehow qualifies Shao Kahn to join her on the Earth in some sort of weird, like, immigration technicality. I don't know how this works, but because he resurrects her, he gets to join to the Earth. Now he's allowed to be on Earth, which means he's allowed to invade the Earth. So, whereas Mortal Kombat 2 took place in Outworld, Mortal Kombat 3 takes place on Earth after Shao Kahn has invaded and wiped out most of the population. So, you get, you know, sort of familiar scenes, but everything is kind of ruined, and there's garbage, and there's, like, you know, rubble, and, you know, some stages have, like, regular things, but there'll be skulls on the ground, so...
Yeah, you mentioned it, the garbage, there's that stage where you've literally got newspaper and such blowing across the screen as you fight. It's really, really cool.
The street just has garbage in the street. Which... I gotta say, like, right off the bat, before we start talking about, like, ups and downs, I feel like this decision, I think, hurts the game right from the get-go, because 2 gave you this sort of exotic, weird fantasy land. Like, what's Outworld like? Whatever we say it's like. Whereas Mortal Kombat 3 is like, what if we're in Chicago? What if we're in the bank? There's literally a stage called The Bank, and it's a bank. It's just...
So
I don't know.
I'm completely with you. Mortal Kombat 3, and we'll get more into this, but it's actually pretty divisive. And one reason for it is the stages. Like, on the one hand, John Tobias and John Vogel were experimenting with a lot of 3D elements. So there are some 3D elements to stages, like the subway, like the street with the papers blowing around. But on the other hand, you're fighting on a street. I mean, it's a street, you know?
I think in this game, personally, I'm quite fond of this game's look. I think it does go for a slightly more realistic appearance here and a darker and dingier appearance. And what it reminds me of is, like, contemporary Image comics like Spawn, color and such. It's not exactly as vivid as that, but that's the impression I get, that that's what they're kind of going for, that sort of darker comic book style that was popular at the time. What I find interesting is the way that the game has this slightly more realistic look, yet everything else about it is so much more outlandish and silly. this game is bizarre. Like, some of the imagery is just weird as hell. Like, way more than in 1 or 2, I think. And, well, we'll get into it. But that's the reason why, while it's not my favorite, I could watch the fatality demonstration over and over again. And I have done.
So, one of the major changes, and I must say, going into this, you know, we can complain about Mortal Kombat 3, we can point out what worked and what didn't work. You have to give them props, they were not sitting on their laurels, they went for it, they decided, we're doing Mortal Kombat 3, and we're not just going to make Mortal Kombat 2 again, we're going to change stuff around. And part of that change involved giving a brand new button. There's actually a 6th button on this thing, and it's the run button. And it lets you run forward for a few seconds, maybe. And there's a meter that literally, you know, there's a new meter that sort of quickly ticks down and comes back up. And if you run at your opponent, you can combo them. This is the first game that actually lets you, actually gives you an on-screen counter, and it actually displays what you did and gives you a combo. But unlike the, you know, other games that are out there, these are very specific chains of commands you enter, and then you do a very specific animation that knocks your opponent down. So you kind of have to know what you're doing. You can, of course, string together moves and do something creative, and you'll, you know, you'll deal damage, absolutely. But if you run into them and you press certain buttons, like, that's an official combo, I think, even with a K, maybe. So,
and sometimes the characters will, like, pull out, like, their weapons for combo strings, right?
Yes,
like,
yes.
Just for a little quick animation. It's an interesting thing, I think.
And it's interesting, but it's also, I guess, controversial is the word, because some people view this as just kind of too limiting. Like, instead of making all combos creative, discoverable in gameplay, you know, jazz, if you will, it's more like a fatality. It's like, oh, if you run forward and you press high punch, low punch, high punch, low punch, then you do a bunch of things and you knock your opponent away. But if you do four high punches, it doesn't work. You do two moves and then you just stop.
So,
you know,
sorry, I know I'm chipping in out of sort of relative ignorance, but they're sort of dialer combos, as they would call them, right? Like,
right.
You have to put these specific things in. You can't really flow into your own sort of combo. Because the later games, like the Deadly Alliance trilogy, they use the same principle of dialer combos, where you just hit, like, triangle, triangle, circle, and then maybe switch stance, you could then hit square. But other than that, you're completely locked into that combo. There's no free creativity there, so to speak. Which, of course, means there is loads of creativity, because this fan base is nuts. But you get what I'm saying. These are very, like, restrictive kind of combos. They're not a organic kind of combo system at all.
So there was an element to this that was introduced in Ultimate MK3, which we'll talk about a little later. Mm. But the problem was that this was around the time when a lot of fighting games were kind of throwing up barriers, maybe unwittingly in some ways, to the casual crowd. The problem with the dialer combos back then is we didn't have a context list in our smartphones. We didn't have smartphones. We didn't have speed dial. If you don't know my phone number, you can't call me. If you don't know the dialer combo, you are at a very big disadvantage. And one of Mortal Kombat's most appealing characteristics, especially compared to Street Fighter II in the Alpha series. Alpha was a little more casual, but it definitely, the entire franchise was catering more to an expert player base, was that, yes, if you know a character better than I do, you'll win, but the playing field was still pretty even. You know, that's why all the characters have the same basic punches and kicks, differentiated only by their special moves and how they can add to juggle. So it did feel more restrictive than Mortal Kombat 1 did. Like, if you're Sub-Zero in MK3, you can still freeze me and do an uppercut. But if I come at you with a 7-hit, 42% damage combo with Shiva, that's a lot more than an uppercut. And you're kind of just going to feel a little shut out.
Exactly. The punishment is not equal in any sense. So, you can't just figure it out. You have to know what
to
do.
There's no combo breaker to borrow the phrase from Killer Instinct. Oh, God.
No, that wasn't introduced in the franchise until Deception, aka MK6. So
blimey,
once you were in, especially juggle combos, touch of death combos, where if one started, you were dead, you lost the round. That, I mean, once you were in, you just had to sit back and watch and hope you'd break out and be able to get some licks in.
Speaking of prolonged specific commands, one of the new gimmicks of Mortal Kombat 3 is what are called combat codes, with Ks, of course. And at the versus screen of any match, there are these little boxes on the bottom of the screen. And player one and player two have to work together. And by pushing buttons on their respective sides, they change the symbols in those boxes. And each combat code has a different effect. And these effects do lots of different things. They can be as simple as turning off throws. They can be as complex as all the characters change every few seconds. They can be as weird as, you know what? Now we're playing Galaga. And I thought what was funny about these combat codes is that they tied directly into the marketing, because every ad for Mortal Kombat 3 could include in the margins just little, like, handwritten notes. And it's like, what is this thing? A skull? A yin-yang? Those were all hints at combat codes that you could then play and try in the arcades. You know, were they useful? I don't know. But it was like one more way to sort of distill information and few more rumors and get people wondering how this works and what it does.
I do like the idea of combat codes, but I think they feed into the whole idea of freezing out new players, to be honest, in a way. Though, of course, you would have to coordinate with another player in order to enter these codes in the first place, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Maybe you could put in the code that turns off run and just play a better game. <I don't know. laughs>
I think that was the big thing. Like, it was a double-edged sword where there were no combat codes that only one player could use, because that wouldn't be fair. If the other player didn't know the combat code, or you were trying to tell them, hey, press these buttons, and they didn't have time, it was something you could just easily miss. Where it really came into play was there was a combat code. The most popular was to turn off throwing. There were a lot of arcades where it was kind of a tacit rule. No throwing. Throwing is cheap. It's too powerful. Don't use that stuff. So players in the know would often turn off throwing and just rely on special moves, basic attacks, and combos.
There's also, this might be, is the Ultimate Combat Code only from Ultimate Mortal Kombat? Or?
Correct. Yes.
Right. Okay. We'll get into that later then.
Well, there's a combat code and then an ultimate combat code. You did enter a combat code at the end of MK3 and you could unlock Cyber Smoke. So yes.
Right. That was the big, it's like after any, at the end of any game, it would show this big screen and it was 10 boxes in a row. So you actually had to operate both joysticks on each side and, like a madman, tap a bunch of buttons up and down really, really fast. And then you would unlock. But once you did that, Smoke was permanently unlocked on that cabinet. So that was a nice touch.
That is a nice touch.
Once you knew what to do. So I remember, like, once that game, you know, once I knew the code, I would, like, travel, you know, I would travel, you know, walk the earth, and then whenever I saw MK3 cabinet, I'd be like, is Smoke open? No. Let me free Smoke for you.
And people would say in hushed whispers, there they are, the the one who makes Smoke happen. I love that.
This is a true story. When this game came out on Super Nintendo, I had the Smoke code, and I walked into a local game store called Dr. Game. And the proprietor was this, like, this, yeah, this great name. And the proprietor was this teenage kid, and I mentioned that I knew the Smoke code. He was like, you are a god! And yeah, that makes you feel pretty good. This was actually, just to get into this briefly, this was Midway's biggest marketing push ever, I believe. This was highly coordinated. They wanted Mortal Kombat 3 Arcade out in the spring of 95, the home version 6 months later, an upgrade for the arcades to appease arcade operators who wouldn't have the 9 to 12 month interval between console versions. And they were building up to the movie. And they came up with combat codes, some exclusive to the coin-op, some exclusive to the home version. They were meeting those out to journalists in certain intervals. This was a huge push, but it was also the stage where John and Ed were really kind of feeling the burn of basically being a Mortal Kombat factory for several years.
I mean, I'm not surprised given how this... I mean, this game is just like an ultimate. It's just so much stuff thrown at it. It's like throwing everything possible at the wall. You know, it's ludicrous. I mean, again, we'll get to it, but the fatalities in this game are just so stupid.
they're terrible.
In an entertaining way, but it kind of breaks the universe in a sense to have this tone clash. But, you know, we'll get to it. I don't want to distract at this point.
Well, before we talk about how these people kill each other, we have to talk about who these people are. And to do that, we have to talk about the fact that there was a major cast shakeup, which led to many character changes. And this is, I would say, the downside to the Mortal Kombat formula. You know, in Street Fighter, Capcom can make all the games they want starring Ryu and Ken and Chun-Li. And Ryu and Ken and Chun-Li are never going to complain about how they're portrayed in these games. But because Mortal Kombat featured real performers with their real faces and their names are there too, there was some friction between the makers of the game and the people who were actually in the game. And really, to start with that, we have to start with Daniel Pacina. And I feel like, David, you're probably the best one to tell the story because there's so much to tell about Daniel Pacina and Midway and Mortal Kombat.
So while I was writing Long Live Mortal Kombat Round 1, anytime my wife would come into my home office to find me with my head in my hands, she'd just say, Chapter 30? And I'd be like, yep. Because this was the single most complicated chapter, to the point where I debated even writing it. Like, I wasn't sure if this book was the right forum to air this. But as a Mortal Kombat fan, I felt like fans deserve the truth. So really, Dan Pacina had, he was upset about compensation, which I think was fair. He was blaming Ed Boon and John Tobias, but it wasn't their fault. They were also employees of Midway. Like, I think one thing people never realized is they never owned Mortal Kombat. It was owned by Midway. Now it's owned by Warner Brothers. They could kind of just do what they were able to do. And they went to bat for the performers saying, hey, they deserve better contracts. And Midway presented them with slightly better contracts. And Dan was one who turned it down and went on to sue them. But the problem with Dan started earlier during Mortal Kombat 2 when Ed Boon would get pretty frustrated at Dan kind of overstepping and trying to be how he now bills himself, which is a stunt coordinator and casting director of Mortal Kombat 2. And Ed would kind of pull John aside and say, I know this guy is your friend, but he needs to back off because we're trying to work here. And so John talked to Ed about this, but even some of the performers who I'll keep them nameless, because they some of Dan's longtime friends would come up to John and say, this guy's killing me here, man. I'm a martial artist. I know what I'm doing. He needs to shut his mouth. And there was no big blow up, but basically John and Ed decided, okay, he's not coming back for Mortal Kombat 3. We don't really need him. We could cast almost anyone at this point because after two games, they had their digitization process down pat. So Dan sued, claimed he was a co-creator, claimed all sorts of things, and the court returned a summary judgment, which is essentially in favor of the defendants, which were Midway, Williams, Nintendo of America, Sega of America. I believe there was one more, but that was the main group. And they basically said, no, this guy doesn't own anything. He didn't create anything. He was, following instructions. And Dan has said he has backstage footage, which was given to him by John Tobias, who admits he was too young to know any better, that this wasn't really his to give away, right? It wasn't his. It was Midway's property, technically. But Dan will show select clips of this behind-the-scenes footage to kind of portray himself as something he was not. But, I dug into this and I said, no, everything Dan's saying is pretty much wrong. He was taking direction from Ed and John the whole time. Dan also likes to say that Ed was hardly involved and asked him and the others if he could get involved in the game he was co-creating. And they said, sure, Ed, get over here. Ha ha ha. Ed was there the whole time. You can see it there. There are screenshots I've taken from all the footage, which I have. A lot of the footage is out there showing this, but Dan just selectively doesn't show it. Or sometimes he does show it, but tries to pretend that what everyone can see is not there. And basically,
so this Dan sounds like an interesting chap.
Yeah, I really went down this rabbit hole. Like, the more interviews with him I watched, the more podcasts with I listened to, he was making up stuff that just wasn't true and that was very easy to disprove. And I even say, like, I end the chapter by saying, like, this guy's legacy was secure. He's the face of Johnny Cage. He was the face, the masked face, but still the face of the ninjas. But that just kind of wasn't enough. And there are some people who, some of the other cast, because Dan is this cult of personality who kind of hits their wagon to his star. And it's really, I've even had some of the cast come to me and say, because of Dan, a lot of us will never be able to work with Warner Brothers. So he's kind of costing us opportunities, which I think is half true. I mean, they're the ones who have chosen to stuck with him. But yeah, it's a whole thing. And all of this happened. I mean, there was a rumor for years that Dan was kind of booted from the Mortal Kombat games because he was doing advertising for other companies. That happened after John and Ed had decided, hey, we got to cut ties with this guy, Even John was like, he's still my friend, but we can't work with him. It's just too much of a hassle. So this was a whole thing, and it had never really come out before. And this chapter, which you can read on Ars Technica, came out on October 8th of last year on the 30th anniversary, which I regret. The timing was out of my hands, but I didn't want to be perceived as happy anniversary. I'm going to rain on your parade. But it was definitely very, very quickly. My phone blew up. My Twitter DMs blew up with people who either believed me or people who very vocally did not. And I was the worst. And it was a whole thing. It's horrible. Yeah. And it was, I have a ton of citations. I backed up everything. But I have no ill will toward Dan Pacina. I just think that one of the problems, the reason he's been able to spread these tall tales is because I think a lot of the enthusiast press and influencers will just kind of repeat anything that they're told, especially you know, Dan seems to be an authority. Like, he was there. He was in the marketing. He was, you know, there behind the scenes videos and stills. So why wouldn't they believe him? But there was just really no fact checking done.
It sounds a little bit like he's got that sort of Tommy Tallarico delusion of like egotism going on.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that for a fact because I don't want to make any unsubstantiated claims about this show.
For sure. I've thought a lot about this too, and I wouldn't want to diagnose him publicly, but you know, you can connect the dots pretty easily, I think. But I just think that, there are a lot of people who still hold him in high esteem. In fact, I've been invited on a lot of fan podcasts to talk about the book, with the caveat that we can't talk about Dan Pacina because he's our friend. And I'm like, so my perspective is if you care about Mortal Kombat as much as you claim to, you should want to know the truth about the history of the franchise, and that making games is always hard, and often there's some ugliness involved. And
it's a shame because he seems like otherwise probably pretty interesting guy to, you know, it's just a shame that there's this, that ugliness there, as you say.
Yeah.
It sort of taints the whole thing a little bit.
It does. And I think the problem is once I kind of, you know, cross-reference all this stuff and realize, you know, 99% of it was false, I kind of realized I can't ever believe anything this guy says. Like, is he a nice guy? Is he, you know, I don't know. I don't know.
I don't want to, obviously I'm not going to speak for you at all because I didn't write this book. I don't know what your process is or how you feel when you write. But you don't want to write something that destroys someone, do you? Like, you don't want to do that, but you do want to tell the truth. So that's a difficult balancing act, I think, as you said.
It was very difficult, even now, which is fine, but I get anxious because I'm like, I'm one of those people, I want everyone to like me, and I really don't want to hurt anybody, but it was not malicious. I think he said humbly that I feel like if you read the chapter, it is very fair, but I just have to point out all these discrepancies and go, look, this does not make any sense, and let me tell you why, you know?
Well, I certainly want Daniel Pacina to be my friend because, let's face it, if he was my enemy, he would destroy me. He's a professional martial artist, and I can't do anything against that. So
he did it with a shadow kick.
Throw fireballs, keep your distance. Yeah.
But as we brought up earlier, we made a joke about Time Killers. So Time Killers was followed up by Bloodstorm, and that was one of the games that Daniel Pacina famously appeared in print advertisements for, basically dressed as Johnny Cage. So he was hyping that game. Mm-hmm. And I think at the time, a lot of us assumed that he did that and then got fired. But no, by the time he was doing that, he was already not invited back, which is why he was doing stuff like that.
Can I make one of my iconic Stuart Gipp interjections briefly?
Yes, please.
Bloodstorm. Is the Simpsons gag Bonestorm inspired by Bloodstorm, or is it coincidence? That's what I'd like to know.
I don't know about the
Bloodstorm has that vibe. It has that vibe, doesn't it? That edgy vibe. But,
you know, I'd have to look at the timing of it all, but I really feel like how many people in the Simpsons writers' room knew about any video games that weren't like on the news? You know, like Bloodstorm was not a household name.
No,
you know? Mortal Kombat was. Bloodstorm was not. So I'd be very curious which came first. Did Bonestorm precede Bloodstorm or vice versa? But I'd have to look it up, and I don't know off the top of my head.
I will say it's
good
just
question, though.
Kind of an addendum to this that I do feel, and it's still this way today, I do feel that the performers were poorly compensated. I mean, they're under the belief, even today, that they own their characters. And I'm like, well, you don't. I mean, Michael Keaton doesn't own Batman. He just played him. So, like, for a long time, they, you know, would show up at conventions in costume, and they got cease and desist from Midway. And some of them are very upset about that. But I'm saying, look, you're not Johnny Cage. You're not this. You're not that. Like, you can still, people know who you are today. You can still sign pictures and stuff, but you don't own these characters at the same time.
Cease and desisting them for dressing up feels a bit harsh to me.
It does feel a bit harsh.
Like, it's cosplay, right?
Yeah, it is cosplay.
Do they C&D people for dressing up as Harley Quinn? I don't think they do.
It is harsh.
But I guess if you're making money out of it, maybe that's some kind of...
If it's Arlene Sorkin, they might.
Yeah. Do you think it's one of those legal things where if you don't exercise it, you lose the right? Like, you know, if you don't challenge these things, you lose the copyright?
I think it might be. I mean, that's to my point, right? Like, I don't feel they've ever been fairly compensated. I just think that they have blamed the wrong people. But it's a case in the industry even today. We've had performers, developers who are just not treated fairly. It's an entertainment thing, not even a game thing. Or, you know, it's an industry, a labor thing. But I feel like they, for a long time, blamed the wrong people, and some of them still do.
So Daniel Patino was not the only person who had this conflict, as we intimated earlier. So Elizabeth Malecki, Dr. Philip Ahn, and Ketelin Zamir all ended up suing Midway, and they basically sort of felt like Daniel Patino was like the vanguard here. It's like, oh, he's suing, so we're also suing because we feel like we haven't been compensated properly. And they allege unauthorized use of their name, persona, home version, spinoff media, all this such. However, their lawsuit did not go very well. The court disagreed and sided with the defendants, which, you know, are the people who made Mortal Kombat, because they felt that in, you know, being photographed and then, you know, being animated, the characters are no longer them. They're just playing a part, and it's clearly distinct from Elizabeth Malecki, ordinary human, and Sonya Blade, who can, you know, fly through the air and, like, you know, scissor kick you.
Kiss you, and then your head explodes.
However, Ho-Sung Pak had a different issue. Ho-Sung Pak really felt that Liu Kang was based closely on himself because, as you might remember from our last episode, Ho-Sung Pak was already a very celebrated martial artist before Mortal Kombat ever existed. He was like a black belt of the year caliber martial artist. So he sought damages on the grounds that this was, you know, this character was based too much on him and too much of his image. He said it was misappropriation, and his case was settled out of court, so we don't know what happened, but it was not dismissed as it was the others, as like it was the other cases.
So there are a few factors there. I mean, one, I think he could make that argument, and he did, but again, as we've talked about in Mortal Kombat 1, he's even dressed like Bruce Lee circa Enter the Dragon, right? He's really playing Bruce Lee, playing Liu Kang. Also, Ho-Sung Pak was a unique case where he had a lot more notoriety. He was arguably the most decorated competitive martial artist of the time, as you touched on. He also was, not only did he play, I think he was the stunt double for Raphael in Ninja Turtles 2, but he was also the stunt coordinator on that movie and Ninja Turtles 3. The less said about that, the better. But he was due to appear in a named role in a Jackie Chan movie. He had a lot more star power. A lot of the basis of the legal arguments was that, hey, these, you know, Dan Piscina, Liz Malecki, Ketelin Zamir, Philip Ahn, they can't say that they're famous for playing these characters because no one knows them from playing these characters.
Yeah.
But relative to them, Ho-Sung Pak did have a lot more fame.
Right.
So that was an issue in his case as well.
Beyond this behind-the-scenes drama, the actual roster of Mortal Kombat 3 reflects a lot of differences from the first previous games. Obviously, with Piscina out, Johnny Cage is not there, but Raiden Scorpion are also missing. And from MK2, Baraka, Reptile, Katana, Molina are also not back. So you've got a huge chunk of the cast from Mortal Kombat 2, which was a very well-received game. They're just not there. So it's kind of, again, It's funny, this is 2 years beforehand, but you can draw a lot of parallels between Mortal Kombat 3 and Street Fighter 3 in that here's your highly anticipated third chapter, and so much of the, you know, so many of the characters that people know and love just aren't there, which I think in hindsight may have been a big mistake.
I mean, cutting Scorpion is wild. Like, that's really wild.
It It was, as John Tobias described it to me, a very calculated risk. John Tobias and Ed Boon knew that, you know, 4 to 6 months down the line, they would be releasing an arcade update to MK3 that would include these characters. But they wanted to... This is actually something I love about Mortal Kombat. I think that when you get a new Street Fighter game, you can make very, very good guesses as to who will return.
Yeah.
But I like that in Mortal Kombat, and this is worked into the lore, your favorites may not always be there. I mean, to Stu and Diamond's point, you know, they have not made the same mistake since of cutting Scorpion. But I do love the fact that, like, there may not be a Katana or a Melina or a Baraka or a Kano or a Sonya or et cetera in the next game. I think that is really bold of them. I like how it's worked into the lore, and I think that it kind of forces people to shake things up and try new characters. I mean, in a lot of the marketing, before I knew Cyrax was Cyrax, he was a yellow-clad ninja. I was like, oh, that's Scorpion, a new look for Scorpion. And of course it wasn't. But that was part of the mystique of Mortal Kombat. You see these screenshots of unnamed characters, and you're like, who is this? Is it new? Is it a new look for a turning character? I've always liked that about Mortal Kombat, that they shake things up.
Even continuing into the sort of era when, in all business sense, they probably shouldn't be doing that. But like Deadly Alliance is festooned with new characters, and that's really the game where they...
Yeah.
I feel like they should have gone nostalgia, but I'm glad that they didn't. I'm glad they stuck to their guns, you know.
So, Liu Kang made the cut. Liu Kang is still here, but he's now played by a new actor, a man named Eddie Wong, an actor stuntman. Kung Lao was back, but Kung Lao was still Anthony Marquez. They didn't have a problem with Anthony Marquez. I guess he didn't because he didn't sue. Sonya returns. However, Sonya, and this is an interesting story. Sonya is now played by Midway regular Kerry Hoskins. And I was already enough of a video game nerd to the point that I recognized Kerry Hoskins in this game. It's like, oh, that's the lady who is in, she was one of the cheerleaders in NBA Jam. And I think if I read even closer, I would have recognized her as Helga, the evil last boss from Revolution X, the Aerosmith shooting game that used digitized actors. Kerry Hoskins was also a Playboy Playmate, so she was a professional model. I don't think she was much of a martial artist, but again, at this point, they know what they're doing. As long as you can throw a punch and, you know, pose like you're throwing a jump kick, they can make you look like you're throwing a jump kick. So she did everything she had to do.
So yeah, in the past, John Tobias, just to look for ways to throw his friends some more money, he would have them stick around set on Mortal Kombat 1 and 2 just to kind of help people, you know, who had to pose and, you know, keep them from falling and make sure they fell on mats. And Dan obviously was not around at this point, so I believe Carlos Piscina picked up a lot of that slack for MK3.
Even though Raiden is not here.
Correct. Raiden was too busy helping the Earthrealm Warriors with martial arts. So there you go.
Although Raiden, it's funny, they do actually have Raiden appear in the attract mode, but just like as an overseer. He's like, I can't help you. Sorry.
Because reasons.
Yeah. Jax is back, as and John Parrish is back. He now has metal arms. And I positive that when we were younger, we all assumed that because he tore people's arms off in Mortal Kombat 2, that Shang Tsung turned into Jax and tore off Jax's arm, so now he had new metal arms. It's an incredibly convoluted explanation, but we all believe that was the truth.
That was actually from John Parrish saying, hey, you know, all these other characters have these cool moves. I want something cool. And John Parrish was like, we're giving you metal arms. And John Parrish was like, that'll work. You know, he's on board with it.
I know it's late again, but the sound those things make is so satisfying when you hit someone with them. Just clong. It's so good.
Clang, clang, clang. Yeah.
Is this the game where he has the fatality where he hammers you into the ground, or is that later? I can't remember.
That's not a fatality for him in this game, I don't think. Unless it's an ML.
Shiva has that. Shiva has that.
Yes.
Oh, right. I may be thinking of Shiva. Oh, well, they're very similar.
Yes. Yes.
Just a couple of arms extra, you know.
So, Sub-Zero is back, but Sub-Zero has a brand new look, along with his new actor, who is, as David mentioned before, John Turk. He's a bodybuilder, he's into Taekwondo, he apparently is an ex-cop. He's not a ninja anymore, and going all the way back to the start of the podcast, he looks like a He-Man extra, I always felt, because he's got these weird sort of, like, suspenders, but, like, his whole chest is out, and he's got a big scar on his face. I feel like he could easily be, you know, that sort of a toy. which maybe they had in mind. I don't know. He's got some new moves. He can throw ice up into the air, which I feel like is pretty impractical, but more practical to the point that it basically breaks the game. He can turn himself into an ice clone, and if you touch the clone, you freeze. And in early versions of the game, he could jump into you and freeze himself, and you couldn't block it, which means he could basically freeze you whenever he wanted to, and it just, it's completely off the rails. And they patched that out in later revisions, but if you play the early versions of the game, he's kind of indestructible if you know what you're doing, so...
Wow.
Whoops! Richard Divisio returns as Kano, so Kano has a new look, but he's still basically the same guy. He is a lot more mobile now. He can cannonball up at an angle. He's got a knife. He can swing this knife around. I think he looks a lot cooler, but his fatalities are a lot sillier. You know, he had a very visceral, simple, you know, Temple of Doom style fatality in the original game where he tore your heart out. Now he can tear your skeleton out and your skin falls off like it's made of rubber. I guess dramatic.
So, in fairness, given that he, you know, has a cardiovascular experience, obviously, and with his knives, maybe he's just a surgeon, Diamond, and you're giving him short shrift. He's just that good at excising skin from the skeleton. You
know? Oh, God, is this the I am a surgeon meme? Are we doing that? Let's not do that.
I guess so.
Okay.
Shang Tsung is back. However, Shang Tsung is also played by John Turk, which means he's younger and buffer than ever before. But I must say, whenever people talk to me about makeup and I tell them that I want to get into more makeup and wear more makeup in my everyday life, Shang Tsung is my platonic ideal. I want Shang Tsung's makeup as seen in Mortal Kombat 3. I want these big black diamonds on my face and, you know, if possible, no pupils, but I don't know. I'm not a contact person, but like, that's the look. I want that look. I want the dark, evil, goth, I'm too busy.
It's really, you know? Cool.
Yeah, that's the look I want.
It's a little bit like an evil Ultimate Warrior kind of thing, I reckon.
I think so.
Then again, the actual Ultimate Warrior was evil as well, wasn't he?
Well, he was troubled. I think troubled is the best term.
Yep, and now he's dead.
Unfortunately, yes.
That was, you know, John Tobias told me that, you know, they thought Philip Ahn did a great job in 2, but he never really liked the look that Tobias came up with for Shang Tsung, and he really felt that they nailed the evil, like, dark sorcerer, necromancer type guy in Mortal Kombat 3. I love Shang Tsung's look in this game.
I love his hair. I wish I had that hair. God.
Yeah. It's another point. In Mortal Kombat 2, he's wearing, like a little beanie. And instead, in Mortal Kombat 3, he's just got this luxurious, long, like, mid, like, down to his back ponytail. It's pretty outrageous. But if we're talking about hair, we got to talk about brand new character, Sindel. Sindel is played by Leah Montalongo, who was just 19 during the filming, you know, another teenager. Not really a martial artist, a dancer, choreographer, fitness instructor. She was actually dating Brian Glynn, who played Shao Kahn at the time, which is probably how she got recommended for this job. She has a gigantic wig on. Her hair is part of her attack. It's part of her weapons. It's one of her fatalities. She also screams a lot. That's another fatality she does. She's got a very distinctive look. She can fly a little bit. Officially, she's Kitana's mother, even though she's not that old, but she's, like, really, really old. Again, Sindel, major lore character, but you wouldn't really know it at the time because she's just a brand new character. We don't really know who this person is.
I think that her fatality, and if I'm wrong again, I'm going to scream. Ironic. That wasn't genuine. That was not intended. I apologize. When she screams so loud that all your skin comes off.
That's in the game.
And there's this disgusting, frozen, like, dripping meat. That, to me, is awesome.
I love,
like,
that
that's one of the few fatalities in this game that I really like. It is over the top, but it's also in character, I think. It makes sense for them. And it's vile. It's really disgusting.
It is. I feel like the vileness of that skeleton would have made me like Kano's skeleton rip fatality a lot more, but instead it's just completely clean. Like, just make that gooey, sticky skeleton model the skeleton model for the game, and I feel like it would have had, you know, Kano's fatality would have had a lot more impact. But yes, I'm with you, Stu. That fatality of Sindel's is awesome.
It's the fact that they're still standing that makes it so good. Like, it's funny.
another brand new character, Stryker. Stryker finally appears after being, you know, on the books, you know, on the early draft character from Mortal Kombat 1 and then 2. Stryker is finally here. He's a cop. And he's played by actor Michael O'Brien. And I've tried to look up Michael O'Brien. I've found very little information about Michael O'Brien. I just don't know what he's up to or where he came from. I'm sorry, Michael O'Brien. But Stryker, I feel like even years before people talked about, you know, how much cops kind of in general suck and how we don't like cops, this character just as presented just wasn't cool. He seemed kind of goofy. Like, he's got a gun, but he only fires it into the air when he wins a match. You have no moves where he actually uses, he doesn't have a fatality where he uses the gun. He would get one in a later revision, but like in vanilla MK3, it's just a prop, which is just to me very silly. And I just remember making fun of him right from the get-go. I never liked him. I'm sorry. You know, Stryker fans, tell me I'm wrong, but I thought he was pretty lame.
Stryker sucks in this game. Like, he's definitely, he definitely doesn't play the role of a cop very well, because a cop would just draw their gun at the drop of a hat and shoot everything.
You'd think so.
Stryker was a lot better in Ultimate Mortal Kombat 3. We can go into that later, but, yeah, I will definitely say, you know, Mortal Kombat 9, I think it was the first game to introduce, like, taunts at the beginning of fights, and his taunt, police brutality coming up, has definitely not aged well at all.
He was, there were rumors that John Cena was going to play him in 11. I don't know where that came from, but that would have been something else.
yeah.
I got to be the guy who likes Stryker because I've got a lineage and, of liking cop games like Police Quest and E-SWAT. Like, cops suck. Cop games can be really fun.
Agreed.
I do like Stryker because he's lame and I like the underdog, you know? A cop is an underdog. Who'd have thought it?
I liked them in Ultimate Mortal Kombat 3 because of a very specific change that they made, but we can get into that. In Mortal Kombat 3 Vanilla, he didn't have a lot of ground to stand on.
I don't know if this is MK3 or UMK3, but I do like his fatality where he throws a grenade and he has this unique fingers in his ears, like gritting his teeth, turn around and hide it. It's very goofy, and that endears him to me, you know?
Yeah, yes. He wires you up with explosives and then covers his ears.
It's great. Yes,
it's very funny. Like, it's a completely unique pose, and it's very funny.
But yeah, his other fatality is just a taser, which, again, that's not so fantastic anymore.
He tases you for so long that you explode, which is also not really aged that well, considering. Let's just agree that everything involving cops has aged poorly in all media.
Speaking of aged poorly, here's Nightwolf. Nightwolf is played by Midway employee Sal DeVita, who had been working, I think, since the NBA Jam days. If you can guess by his name, Sal DeVita, he is not a native at all. He's just a white guy wearing native makeup. So, yeah, I think the character obviously has a lot of lore implications, and I think the character has some cool aspects to it, but it's also, like, it's basically red face, you know? So, not great.
The entire foundation of the Mortal Kombat series is somewhat problematic. That's not to excuse it, obviously, but it's always kind of been there in a way. I've got to be honest, though, I think Nightwolf is cool. Having all these, like, spectral-like animals and things, I think is a really cool concept for a character. It's just a shame that it couldn't have been, you know, authentic.
Yeah, he's an absolute beast of a character to play. He's got some really fun juggles.
You know, it's funny, you want to talk about coincidences, this is 1995, this is the same year that Star Trek Voyager debuted. Star Trek Voyager famously had a native character on the bridge, but all their research and input came from an expert who was not native and just made up a bunch of shit. He was a liar, like a professional liar.
God's sake.
So,
I shouldn't laugh, but that is really funny.
The actor was also not native, but at least the actor in the case of Voyager was a Mexican American actor. So I feel like at least there's some equity there. But, Sal DeVita, not native, not Mexican. But you know, who's not native or Mexican, but more mysterious is Cabal. Cabal, in fact, Richard Vizio pulling double duty here. But now this time, instead of wearing a rubber mask or a half mask, he's wearing a full face mask. You can't see anything.
It's a little bit like a gas mask, yeah.
Yeah,
it's,
exactly.
And Cabal's cool as shit.
Yes, he is.
He's a little bit too cool because they gave him too many moves. And in the original Mortal Kombat 3, if you know what you're doing, you can do like a 50% combo. It's pretty absurd.
He's a very unusual visual design character. Like, I don't know who there's a lore reason for it, but like, what is his deal? Like, what is he? Is he Red Bat Dragon? Isn't it called? I forget. The thing that Kano's part of.
Yeah, he was like a Black Dragon member, and then he was attacked by Shao Kahn's extermination squad, which is why he needs the respirator.
Yeah.
So I think in some stories, like he turns into a hero character, but yeah, that's the lore reason for the respirator,
which you can use in fatality to inflate your head and you pop like a balloon.
Yeah.
Which is somehow his least silly fatality.
Yeah.
This game is full of daft crap, though, as we've said. It's just, we're going to get to it, but the fatality which destroys the entire planet, you know. I mean, it's fun, but it does kind of hurt the game, I would say. It does destroy the sense of, like, verisimilitude that the previous game had. I know I'm sort of repeating the same point, so I'll get off the subject now, but as we go through the characters and like, we're remembering these silly, silly changes, these weird sprites that they added in that just don't quite work. Yeah, sorry, we'll get to them, obviously, but Cabal's definitely one with an unfortunate fatality set.
I would argue that as far as weird sprites go, Shiva works because Shiva is essentially a female Goro. So she's not an actor. She is, you know, a model, a stop motion creation. And I think she works because she is really weird. She also sounds really weird. I don't know who's, I think David, you once said that Ed Boon did all the voices. I don't know if that's still the case here, but her voice sounds especially inhuman, which I think works because it makes her seem even more alien.
She's kind of in my experience of playing this game, she's kind of a noob filter because she has a move that's just literally does press down then up, and if you don't know how to avoid it, you can just stomp people consistently with it because it is actually quite hard to avoid if you don't know how. She's a bit of a filter in that respect, but once my friends figured out how to dodge that was it. I was doomed. But she's being a Shokan. Is this the first time in the series you've been able to play as a Shokan? Am I imagining that? I don't know if Goro is playable in the console ports or anything.
No, this is the first time.
Yeah. Oh, wait, Kentaro Morph. I guess that counts, but yeah.
Yeah, just for a fatality, so you're not really playing. Yeah. So you're still right.
Okay.
Yeah, and Shiva, unfortunately, bottom of the tier list in the MK3 games. Wow. Except for Trilogy, which we'll talk about later.
Yeah, unless you're me.
Yeah, unless you're you with the unbreakable, unblockable teleports.
And Stu, since you mentioned earlier, she also has a fatality where she tears off your skin and that skeleton just stands there. So
dripping.
She also has that one.
The Pyramid Head from the Silent Hill movie.
However, I think in the original game, if you're playing Shiva and you tear off Shiva's skeleton, there's only two arms because they didn't make more than one sprite.
That is correct.
So let's talk about the robots. They decided not to bring back any ninjas in Mortal Kombat 3 because they've decided to go with cyborg ninjas. And I feel like on paper, that is just the right amount of stupid. But I think in execution, they made the costume too stupid. Am I making any sense here? I don't know. I feel like
The lore here is like Sub-Zero's clan, like the Lin Kuei in the future or something, decide that for some reason all the Lin Kuei have got to become robot ninjas now.
Yes.
As part of their like progress.
Yes.
Because I know they get heavily into it in Mortal Kombat 9, which is essentially a reboot of these games. These characters are like deep lore characters, basically. There's a lot going on with these chaps. And they are really stupid. Like, oh, they're so crushingly dumb. I mean, they do look kind of cool, but they're also ridiculous. Like, they've got the stupidest fatalities, like the self-destruct and releasing a million little bombs that destroys the entire planet. And that one where it's like they put you in this weird crusher that comes out of your chest.
I kind of like that one. It might be the least stupid, because overall I agree. I do think I kind of like their look, but they, you know, they leaned a little.
Yeah.
You know, it's always funny to learn that, like, even a game as big as Mortal Kombat didn't have a huge budget, right? Like, they were still kind of rounding up costumes, like used costumes from costume shops and stuff. But these characters have, like, Cyrax and Smoke especially are really, really fun to play. Smoke is, once you unlock him, he's basically Scorpion. He has a different teleport punch where he comes up from the bottom like Sektor, but he has Scorpion's spear, and he has some really great dial combos. He's really, really fun to play.
Yeah, I definitely... The other reason I unlocked Smoke on every cabinet I could is because I always wanted to play Smoke, because he was the closest Scorpion as you had. But they all had... Yep. I mean, they all have their own sort of... I think they are interesting characters to play. I just feel like they look sillier than they needed to be. I think that, like, you know, as you said, maybe they didn't have the costume budget, or it just didn't photograph right. I don't know. I always felt they looked like a predator wearing motocross gear because they have, like, dreads. I think it was very strange.
I can see that.
There are three robots in vanilla Mortal Kombat 3, and they are called Cyrax, who's yellow, there's Sektor, who's red, and there's Smoke, who's gray, and he smokes. But they're all played by Sal DiVita wearing this sort of costume, which I don't think works as robots go. Also, the robots bleed black, I guess because it's like oil? I don't know. It's a weird choice. But rounding out the cast, Noob Sabat returns as a hidden character again. However, since there's no ninjas anymore, it's now Shadow Kano. So it's basically Divizio all black.
Which I always thought was an odd choice, because they could have just used the unmasked Sub-Zero palette. Like, he's all black, so you couldn't tell that he's not wearing a ninja costume anyway. But yeah, there's just a lot of weird choices with Mortal Kombat 3. And this to me is one of them. I feel about Noob Saibot's look in this iteration of MK3 as you do with the robot's appearance, I think.
Well, they'd undo it a few months later.
Yes.
So for bosses, however, they made a slight change. After two games of what if you fought giant with four arms, they said, what if you fight a giant centaur? So he's got four legs.
Oh my god, this guy.
Yeah,
this guy. Massive, but it's a massive centaur, and I feel like the internet has caught up with this. I think the internet's way more into centaurs now than they were in 1985. But he's a beast. He automatically reflects projectiles, which I feel is completely bonkers. I can't believe you would make a character that just automatically reflects projectiles. That is insane.
If by some miracle I can get to Mataro, that's it. My game's done. Like, I can't get past Mataro.
He is the worst.
It's ridiculously hard. Ludicrous. And the thing that I find about Mataro is, compared to Goro and Kentaro, he doesn't even look cool. I mean, it is the novelty of him, of being a centaur, but outside of that, it's just almost just like a Hell Knight from Doom, the top half of a Hell Knight from Doom, stuck on the back of a horse, isn't it?
He makes Doom noises, for sure. He definitely sounds like a Doom monster.
He does. He does. There was a change to the mechanics in Ultimate MK3 that actually trivializes him, but we can talk about that in a bit.
And his last boss, Shao Kahn, returns as the last boss. Still played same actor, still voiced by same actor. The only thing really new about Shao Kahn is that he has a hammer, and I think he says more things during the game that he didn't say in the last game. I also think he might... I think it's new in this game that he can actually point at you on the ground and taunt you. I think that's new for MK3.
This is weird to me, because, like, he invaded Earthrealm so fast that I guess he didn't have time to, like, build a house or an arena. So you just fight him in the pit 3. He's like, yeah, this is temporary. I haven't moved into my house yet. So you just fight him in the pit 3.
And I don't think he can knock you in. Is there room for him to knock you into the pit? I don't think there is.
Nope. No way. He, like, in all the bosses in the arcade games, with the exception of Shinnok and MK4, they don't have fatalities, and you cannot perform fatalities of any kind on them.
They just read your moves and kill you, basically.
Yeah.
So, we do have fatalities. Of course fatalities are back, of course fatalities are back, of course friendships are back. As we've alluded to, though, a lot of the fatalities this time around just seem silly or stupid or just confusing. Like, I looked at Jax. I think Jax is, like, the perfect in encapsulation of this. Like, in Mortal Kombat 2, Jax had two of the best fatalities. They were so guttural. They were so simple. I'm going to crush your head, or I'm going to tear your arms off. And in both cases, you're going to hate them. You're going to hate this feeling when I do this to you. And in Mortal Kombat 3, his two fatalities are, he turns his arms into knives and chops you up into very bespoke pieces, like very distinct little pieces.
Yeah, like Baraka's you, basically.
Yeah, but it looks silly, because your body part, like, falls into very distinct parts instead of, like, slime or, like, gross stuff. It's just, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's just like they've just cropped them in MS Paint, basically.
Exactly.
Well, and when you look at those parts, the arms are just kind of hanging in midair.
Exactly, exactly. It's very cheaply done. And his other fatality is he turns into a giant and steps on you.
Okay.
What?
This might be tied for me with Smoke's, like, Armageddon fatality. Like, I can buy the knife chop fatality because, like, he also fires missiles from his arms. So you're like, okay, the arms can do things. I don't know all the things they can do, but they are malleable. But, like, Jax is a giant? Like, it just... a lot of the fatalities have always been... Not always, but in most cases, they are extension of the character. You know, Baraka impales you on his knives. Scorpion is undead and breathes fire. Jax using his knives is fine. I think the part people hate about that is the evenly sized pieces, which just look silly. But a giant? Jax is a giant? Is that like... Was that an upgrade that they threw in with the arms? Like, hey, you paid a lot for this. So you get giant abilities for free? Like, I don't know where that came from, and I hate it.
It's just very, very strange. Likewise, Liu Kang is one where he disappears, and a Mortal Kombat 1 cabinet crushes you, and then he reappears.
The fourth wall, I barely knew her. I don't know where that one is from either.
I don't have any issue with the fatalities. No inherent issue with them being silly. Right. But the fact that the game itself looks more... it looks more realistic. It has a earthier kind of down-to-earth look to it, I think. It's very jarring, and it makes them look garish and kind of trashy, and like they don't really fit. I mean, stuff like Reptile's head growing vast when every time it takes a bite of your body, which he also does in the bespoke like segments. I mean, he has the other. There are some good ones, like the acid spit fatality that Reptile does, I think is really well done. But mostly, they're all just so big and goofy, and it's almost just kind of like a case of just because you can do this doesn't mean you should, you know?
Yeah, I'm pretty hard on the fatalities of this game, and I do think there's definitely. They are jarring when you look at the grittier art style, for sure. But I also feel like they leaned into certain aspects of them so that you became desensitized. Like, again, so many fatalities cause you to explode, often inexplicably. Like, Johnny Cage in Trilogy, he, like, breaks your spine over his knee, and that is so painful that you just erupt. And there are multiple skulls and rib cages and, like, four arms and six legs, and it's just... It doesn't make any sense. And I feel like, I don't know, a lot of the fatalities, I'm okay with the silliness too, because Boone and Tobias have always had a sense of humor, but a lot of them just feel kind of phoned in compared to the more creative fatalities in Mortal Kombat 2, especially.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also the fact that there were a lot of explosions in Mortal Kombat 2, but there would be like a pile of bones and what looked like guts on the ground. Whereas Mortal Kombat 3, what you get look like mannequin parts. Like, they look exceptionally false.
Yeah, they're just kind of generic, right?
Yeah.
Like, plasticky arm, plasticky leg, which is especially weird when you consider, I guess, the cyborgs having blood and body parts is okay, because cyborgs are, you know, partly human. But, like, with Shiva and just other characters, it just really sticks out. Those discrepancies really stick out.
And we also have to mention the fact that beyond regular fatalities, they've created a brand new kind of fatality, which is an animality. And it's so needlessly complicated. You have to be in round 3. You have to perform a special new concept called a mercy, where you beat your opponent you go to the opposite end of the screen, and you give them back a little bit of life.
Now, how do you do that again? You hold.
Then you have to kill them again.
You hold block and do something, right? To do a mercy, I'm trying to believe so. Command.
You hold run and tap down 3 times, and I think you have to be like sweep distance. One of those fairly specific Mortal Kombat things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you have to be far enough away that you can't just like hit them right away. So you give them a chance, essentially. You give them another bit of life, you get a chance, but then you kill them again, and then you can do the animality. And I feel like, you know, 2 years later, the morphing fad isn't quite as hot. The morphs in this game look especially shitty. Like, you morph into a monster, like an animal, but it's like neon colored. Like, it doesn't look cool at all. Like, Liu Kang's dragon morph in MK2 was astonishing. You're like, whoa, look at that. And it had a great sound, and it was a surprise. And in this game, everyone has an animality, and almost all of them play out exactly the same. You turn into some weird Photoshop character, you crawl onto your opponent, they scream, and blood flies into the air, and just like, oh no, it's eating you. Oh no.
Yeah, this is a weird thing. I don't like the fatalities. Like, I applaud Boone and Tobias for, you know, kind of polling the community, finding out that animalities, which were rumored in Mortal Kombat 2, were a thing, and being like, okay, let's make those. And they're sufficiently hidden, but they're just not worth the effort. And again, it has to do with extensions of characterization to me. Like, okay, Sub-Zero, if he's going to turn into a really weird, like, sticker-looking single-color animal, a polar bear, that makes sense. Shang Tsung, snake, makes sense. He has kind of a snake-like pose in the versus screen and in the game. But the rest, it's like, I don't know, some of them like turn into wasps, and there's, you know, Scorpion doesn't even turn into a scorpion. It's weird. It's
no,
bizarre.
I think Cabal's, like, another character has a scorpion, so Scorpion can't.
Yeah. It's
absolutely absurd. Absolutely ridiculous. The wide open goal there, and he completely missed.
So, at the time, I would say, you know, I was still way into Mortal Kombat when Mortal Kombat 3 came out. I put a lot of coins in this game, and I definitely bought the home version when it came out in the fall, which was a very quick turnaround, obviously by design. But I definitely was disappointed at the time. I was like, this isn't, you know, after Mortal Kombat 2 blew me away compared to 1, 3 was kind of like, oh, you didn't have as many good ideas this time around, did you?
It just felt like, I don't know, it was like a C-. Like, I liked the dial combos, I liked some of the new systems, but they really didn't come into their own until Ultimate Mortal Kombat 3. But in terms of, like, the fatalities, this was also a point when, like, the breath of life given to arcades, largely by Street Fighter 2, but then also Mortal Kombat a year or so later, was, like, kind of starting to fade. 3D fighting games were really picking up, so there was a point that, like, people were kind of over the novelty of the digitized actors, and they were playing games like, you know, Tekken and Virtua Fighter and stuff. It's the third one of those.
Yeah.
You know, there was some franchise fatigue setting in.
Right. The idea of a video game containing violence just is not nearly as shocking as it was, you know, 3 years earlier.
And there, you know, there's a visceral quality to the fatalities of Mortal Kombat 1 and 2, where it's like, I don't know that a lot of parents were super upset about smoke blowing up the world. They were probably like, what is this ridiculousness?
It's very Looney Tunes. Yeah. So we've teased it. Let's talk about it. Let's talk about Ultimate Mortal Kombat 3, which arrived in arcades in November of 1995. As you said earlier, David, it exists because the home versions came out so quickly. They wanted to make sure arcade operators were getting their money's worth. So they came with this idea of like, well, what if we, you know, this is basically, I would say that it's like their version of, you know, Champion Edition or Super Street Fighter 2, in that it's the same game, but we've added a few new characters, we've remixed a few things, we've edited a few things, and it's just, it's a bigger, bolder version of what was already out there. And one of the big changes is the fact that they went back and they filmed more actors, and they brought back the ninjas. So John Turk is now a ninja. He plays Scorpion. He plays Reptile. He plays a new character called Ermac. He's a red ninja. And he plays classic Sub-Zero because one Sub-Zero wasn't enough. I don't know the thinking of that process, but there's basically four ninjas now. They also have newcomer Becky Gable, a model dancer, and she is Katana, she's Melina, she is Jade. Again, I think a poor move, which I think they fix in later games, Jade is essentially Becky Gable colored to be black, and I think they would hire a black actor later, but I don't know that Jade looked necessarily African-American in Mortal Kombat 2, but in 3, she definitely looks like a black woman, but she's not black. Becky Gable is just not black. So I think that was a mistake.
Well, it is sort of blackface. So
yeah. It's like digitally colored. Yeah.
Yeah. There is sort of a relic. There is a difference in a sense, but the ultimate result is not great. I mean, of course they have, you know, fixed it now. So,
but still, that's a lot of, even though it is essentially two actors being repeated, that is a significant increase of number of overall characters. I know I definitely appreciated new Scorpion. I thought the combos were fun. I thought his new fatality was fun, where he basically summons a bunch of other scorpions from hell.
That was
cute.
Yeah.
I like that one a lot.
Ludicrous. Absolutely ludicrous, but it's great.
They added some new stages. They rebalanced some characters. I guess certainly Stryker changed a lot because they let Stryker use his gun.
So Ultimate Mortal Kombat 3, I was pretty hard on Vanilla MK3, but I love Ultimate MK3, and we're about to get into why. This is really the blueprint for all Mortal Kombat games, all successful Mortal Kombat games that followed. Everything they did here just really hit. The roster was great, and the mechanics were great, made so by the biggest addition, which was the linker punch. So in Mortal Kombat 3, the hard thing about the dialogue combos was like you had to get next to an opponent on the ground and hope that they held still long enough for you to do it or didn't block. Which is why it kind of behooved people to play characters like Sub-Zero or Cyber Smoke, who had a stun move. Mm. In this, any character can do a flying punch, high punch or low punch, and immediately transition into a dial-a combo. It opened up a lot more setup. It opened up some wild juggle combos. And it was just hugely influential. There was also another move. I think every character almost... Every character has one called a launcher, where from the ground you can pop them into the air and then go into a juggle combo from there. Like Nightwolf has one where he pops you up with his hatchet at the end of a dial combo, and then you can hit them with the hatchet like 3 or 4 more times, continuing to juggle them.
Wow.
And then do his shadow shoulder slam, which I can only imagine he somehow stole from Johnny Cage. And it's just like devastating amount of damage. Also, Smoke could turn into human Smoke in this game, and he was actually a better... I'm jumping ahead a bit, but it was funny because he was actually a better Scorpion than Scorpion because he had a launcher where I don't think Scorpion did. He's top tier in this game along with Cabal. Human Smoke specifically.
Yes, Human Smoke is there as like a second hidden character, and also Noob Saibot is in the game again. But he's now a ninja again, but he's all black. So it's basically John Turk again.
Right.
They brought back endurance matches, which I thought was a nice touch. They were not present in MK2, but they were back in MK3. One of the very strangest ideas, though, I guess, again, in a pre-internet world, you want this, but when you beat the game in Ultimate Mortal Kombat 3, you get this giant row of boxes, and it says, pick your reward. And each box does something different. And one box is just like, here's your ending. It's all text. Whereas other ones are like, fight a hidden character, fight two hidden characters. And one of the boxes is like, what if you just want to watch some fatalities? Like, of course, at that time, that was the only way to actually just watch fatalities. There was no YouTube, of course. But in hindsight, it is kind of wild to think like, that's just an option you can just do. And just, you win the game and then you just sit there, you know, for about 6 to 7 minutes watching it throw all these animations at you.
Which also included babalities, and that got really annoying after about 3 or 4 of those.
You know what got really annoying is hearing the noise, da-da-dum!
But everyone loved
it. Over again.
Stu, you mentioned this earlier, like my friends, anytime they'd have me beat the arcade version, since I was the best MK player. And then, like, Ultimate Demonstration. And this is before YouTube. So, like, we would just watch this, like, 20-minute long thing, and it was just endlessly entertaining.
Also, I should add that, you know, in running down these characters, three of the characters I mentioned earlier were actually locked. So instead of the single combat code that unlocked Smoke, you had a choice of three different characters you could unlock with three different combat codes in this game. But all of them were very long, very complicated, and you really had to, again, you had very little time. And I think you could only do one at a time, too. So you couldn't just, like, do one coin and do them all. Like, you had to... You really had to plan these out. You probably needed help,
so
too.
This is another case of once they're unlocked, they're permanently, or say permanently, in the ROM, so to speak.
Yes.
Cool. I did not know that. That's really cool. I know that other fighting games would use things like timed release of characters, like Tekken did that, I think.
Yes.
Where every week or so another character would unlock, but Mortal Kombat, no.
So, Ultimate Mortal Kombat 3 arrives almost at the same time as the home versions arrived, and I think Ultimate MK3 did get certain home ports, but really, am I wrong on that, David? I think there were home ports of Ultimate, weren't they not?
There were, yeah. It's definitely on the Mega Drive and the SNES. I bought the Mega Drive cartridge earlier this week, actually.
Oh,
To see what it was like.
Yeah.
So they definitely exist.
They're really kind of cool, because they're kind of, the Mega Drive and SNES version specifically, kind of straddle the line between Ultimate MK3 and Trilogy. Like, they include Noob Saibot and Rain, which didn't become... Neither of those became playable until Trilogy. They included Brutalities, which is actually a common mistake people make. A lot of people believe Trilogy introduced them, but the home versions of UMK3, I believe they were out first.
Oh.
Well, I mean, the MK3 itself, just vanilla MK3... had a PlayStation and Saturn, I want to say, but not Ultimate for some reason.
Yeah, so like Ultimate was on Saturn, but not PS3. MK3 was on PC, DOS and Windows versions, but never Ultimate. So it really did skip around until Trilogy was kind of on everything, but there were huge differences in how they played. We'll get into that.
Sure. But yeah, that's what I was getting to. So after a bit of... different platforms have different ports now. Starting in 1996, some versions came out in 97. They created a game called Mortal Kombat Trilogy, which, you know, at the time, this is a pre-Mugen world. It's like, here's all the characters we can possibly fit into one ROM. And similarly,
this is their version of Dream Match, I guess.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
We should also add that Mortal Kombat Trilogy is a home exclusive. There was no arcade version. It came out on home consoles. I believe Nintendo 64 was the first version, but it came out to almost every home console and DOS.
Yeah, it was Saturn, PlayStation, and DOS, as you say, as well as N64. I think also the Tiger Gamecom had a version of this as well.
I've got to mention that.
But yeah, Mortal Kombat Trilogy is just this sort of absurd amount of characters. And I don't think they really were particularly careful about balance or anything like that. That it's like, here's everybody we could possibly get in here. Rain graduates from fake character to real character. It's a purple ninja. Get it? It's purple Rain. Noob Saibot, playable. Johnny Cage.
That is genuinely the first time I've ever got that. Thank you. I'm not joking. I didn't get that. That's great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I didn't know that until recently. Like, in research, I'm like, oh, I get it. Wow. Yeah.
Johnny Cage is back, recast as model athlete Chris Alexander. Raiden comes back, and technically Raiden is still Carlos Pocina, but they got Richard DeVizio to play him on the Versus screen. I don't know why that is, but Raiden's back. And depending on which version you own, there are playable bosses, but not all the bosses. It varies depending on what you have. Also, Shang Tsung can only turn into some of the bosses, maybe not all the bosses. But of course, if you're playing on like a PlayStation or a Saturn, he can only morph into certain characters because they simply can't load all the characters at once. So you have to like choose which characters you want to be. So mathematically, you probably want to pick a ninja, because if you pick one ninja, you can be all the ninjas, I think. Plus, it's just a matter of sprite
work. As I mentioned earlier, if you do the morphs, you're going to be despised by the second player because of the disc accessing that you're going to make them sit through.
But there was, in the options menu, you could choose like which characters to enable and which to disable. So that helped a little.
There was quite a lot of customization. There was also secret options menu as well, wasn't there?
Couple, I think.
Yeah, there's a lot of customization here. It's very cool.
This is why I vastly preferred the N64 version, because it was a big cartridge, and even though that meant it couldn't fit every character on there, I think Goro and Kentaro are missing. It is a cartridge, so if you play Shang Tsung, he can morph instantly. He can morph into almost everybody. You don't have to worry about any of that stuff. And,
no, you know, I'm not sure. I might be noted here and I'm missing it, but just to be really awkward, they had an exclusive character for each version, right? Like the N64 version had Chameleon with a K, which is the female Chameleon, I want to say.
That's correct.
So they took after, I want to say, Milana, Chameleon and Katana.
And Jade, yeah.
And Jade, excuse me, sorry. And the PS1 and Saturn DOS versions, I want to say, had Chameleon with a C, who took after, I want to say, the Ninjas. Was kind of warping colors. So this is just a trivia note, really, but when Mortal Kombat Armageddon came around and claimed to have every character, no! It missed one of the Chameleons, and I'm going to die mad about it.
But as David mentioned earlier, the brutalities may have appeared in home ports of UMK3 first, but basically brutality is essentially a very long combo that lets you makes your opponent explode, but you have to learn a lot of moves, so it's really intensive. Absurdly so, I would say.
So once your aggressor meter is full, you can just pull off this move. That's what it's for.
So brutalities are actually finishers. Yes. They were inspired, I believe, by Killer Instinct's Ultra combos, which is the same deal. Probably. Although they had to, with those, you had to start them when your opponent's life was like in the flashing danger zone. Mm-hmm. But in Mortal Kombat, you wait for the finish him or her, and then you punch in this absurdly long combo that I would try once and then never bothered to memorize, because it's just the same thing for every character. Everybody just explodes with an uppercut at the end.
Yeah, the aggressor.
Not a fan.
The aggressor meter is kind of like, well, I mean, it's a meter. But there's no super moves or anything. It's something that fills up as you play, as you attack. And I think it goes up even faster if they're blocking. So it's just a way to get you to move, you know, be more aggressive, literally. But once it's full, it just makes you faster. Like there's no actual like unlocks or anything. You don't get to do like a super move.
I believe it was done partially in response to turtling, because in Mortal Kombat games, I think since the first one, or if not at least MK2, or like if you held down and back and block, you couldn't be thrown anything. And so aggressor basically rewarded, like if you pulled off combos on a blocking opponent, your aggressor bar would fill up even faster. Like it really rewarded offense and aggression.
I agreed. So it's well named. And at this point, I believe Trilogy is available on GOG.com. So if you want to have a huge Mortal Kombat love fest, I guess in 2D.
Yeah.
This is probably the easiest way to do it.
I think that also the version that they're selling is prepackaged with a sort of a launcher that might be a fan-made thing, because I know that I had no trouble getting it working. And there was definitely some kind of stuff there that I'm pretty sure isn't normally there. So it's a very, very good version of the game. They put a lot of love into that.
But obviously, at this point, you know, this came out in 96, 97 in some places. I think one version maybe even was 98. But obviously, at this point, they're well on their way to making Mortal Kombat 4, which is, of course, is going to be a 3D game. So this is kind of like their farewell to 2D sprites and their farewell to digitized actors as we know it. So it really is sort of the end of an era, in a way.
There were obviously ports following this. Mortal Kombat Advance, which is a piece of trash, don't even think about playing it. And there's Mortal Kombat, Ultimate Mortal Kombat on the DS, which is actually rather good.
Great, yeah.
I'd recommend that one. I'm pretty sure that's the one. That one has like move lists on the bottom screen and stuff. It's really good.
Another development note here. Part of Midway's Williams' very aggressive plan in 1995 was they were kind of looking at the sales of Acclaim's home ports, which were selling in the millions, whereas they were moving tens of thousands of arcade units at Midway. And they said, why are we giving other people a slice of the pie? So they acquired TradeWest. They turned them into Williams Entertainment and basically devoted, like, the first project internally, I believe, was the home ports of Mortal Kombat 3. So Ed Boon and John Tobias were actually, like, sending code and sprites and backgrounds and all that stuff. And the home and arcade version of MK3 were in development in parallel. So that takes us to Trilogy, which was actually made by Williams with some support by Boon and Tobias, who were working on MK4 and MK Mythologies, respectively, at the time.
Oh, God, I can't wait for the MK Mythologies episode.
That does explain a lot of the timeline, then. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and the Trilogy kind of started what I think you could consider a trend, where at the end of an era, in this case the 2D sprite-based era, they kind of had the gangs all here brouhaha with every character, which I always thought was kind of funny, because for a series predicated on over-the-top violence and death moves, no one had died, which is always kind of funny to me. But Armageddon was sort of the same thing, with the absence of one chameleon, as Stu pointed out, for the 3D era. So a lot of people are wondering, going into Mortal Kombat 12, like, could this be the end of the modern era? Are we going to see another, like, greatest hits sort of album, or will it be more traditional Mortal Kombat with some absences and some new faces?
Well, as it's recording, listeners, we don't know. What do we know? Well, we know that we've been talking for almost 3 hours now, and I'm getting a little loopy. So perhaps we should wrap things up. And I don't know. I guess there's really no controversy here. I think we can all agree that of these games, MK2 is best?
You know what? There actually is, I wouldn't call it controversy, but there's some divisiveness.
Okay.
In the pro scene, Ultimate Mortal Kombat 3 is considered the definitive version over Trilogy, because Trilogy is kind of broken and imbalanced in some ways. I mean, Rain, Noob Saibot, and the bosses are broken. They're banned from tournament play.
Right.
Also, the versions of Trilogy are different. A lot of people prefer the N64 version because since they had to cut sprites and frames, some characters that were previously weak, like Sheba, is at the top of the mountain. She can juggle you with her crouching kick, which people call the toe tickler. That's an infinite, it's an infinite combo in the corner. She just kind of has this really dainty, like, up motion kick where she just hits you with her two toes and juggles you to death. Ultimate Mortal Kombat 3, everyone could play it. You know, it was in arcades. It was everywhere. And, you know, between basic attacks, special moves, dialogue combos, jugglers, and launchers, like, that's kind of why I said that game specifically is the blueprint for the series. Like, it was unbalanced in some ways, but nowhere near as grossly as Trilogy. So I think from the competitive side, like, Ultimate MK3 is still played today, but Mortal Kombat 2 definitely is, like, probably the most popular classic version overall, because it's where it's almost like Street Fighter 2, where a lot of people started, like, that was their entry point into the series. It was that big in popular culture.
I mean, of course, I mean, it helps, obviously, that it was the one that had, you know, relative parity between the home ports as well.
Well, it was just this perfect storm, right? Because, like, it was vastly improved. The parity between the home ports was great. This was also at the pinnacle of the arcade resurgence, like, right before things started to kind of drop off and home consoles became very, very close to arcade hardware. Like, Mortal Kombat 2 just did everything right. From even the tone and the aesthetic as well. Like, a lot of that stuff in 3 is questionable. Mortal Kombat 2, tone-wise, is damn near perfect.
You know, it's funny. You mentioned the music there. Because Mortal Kombat 3 came home during the disc era, I know that when I got my copy, it was, you know, it's just on a CD. So I thought it was – I was ecstatic that I got essentially – with my game, a free soundtrack CD, because if you put it in a CD player, you can just listen to the Mortal Kombat 3 soundtrack, which I must say, for all the changes that they made that I think were shaky, I think the music of MK3 is generally pretty good, and especially the Subway, I think the Subway is excellent. I love the Subway music for MK3.
Same. It's great.
It's a good track. I might be 100% wrong on this, so feel free to edit this out, but I think that Mortal Kombat 2 actually got a late port to the PS1 as well, the PlayStation. I'm almost certain there's a PS1 version of that game. Mm-hmm. If I'm wrong, then I'm wrong. But it's interesting that that was out on PlayStation, because it feels like it predates that by quite some time. But yeah, it's there. So weird.
It's possible. I mean, I'm sure at the time I would have looked at that and said, oh, but I have MK3 now. I don't need MK2. But
that's what makes it so odd. I'm almost certain it exists, and I'm going to have to check, because if I'm wrong, this is very embarrassing.
Mortal Kombat 2's home versions were pretty weird.
Yeah, that's like, right. It does exist. Good. It does exist.
Yeah. I think it was, it might not have been like in the West. I think it might have, like, it came out in Japan. But yeah, there's a lot of interesting stuff around Mortal Kombat 2's home versions.
So, any final words on the topic of 2D Mortal Kombats that we've discussed today? We discussed a lot of them.
I think we've said every word that could conceivably be said about these games. This has been very exhaustive, and it's been lots of fun as well.
Yes.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. Like, I think that as hard as people, even diehard fans were on, I mean, there were people who approached vanilla MK3, took one look at the select screen, said, no Scorpion, and then just walked away. But Ultimate MK3 is really a great game. I prefer 2, but I think, like, gameplay-wise, 3 is where everything came together, and kind of that's where the series found itself. And then Trilogy is just a great party game. It's a lot of fun.
I mean, I guess I want to mention the fact that they're teasing Mortal Kombat 12 now, so we're heading into the future soon. Hopefully, knowing the Retronauts curse, by the time this goes out, they'll have aired a full trailer for it or something. But I'm really looking forward to that. I think it's one of the series that has managed to overcome a hump period, or at least two hump periods, and then come back blazing, to be honest, and that's quite impressive.
And commercially, it is the best-selling franchise in the world. It left Street Fighter behind a long time ago, which is saying something, because, you know, Mortal Kombat, even into, I would say, the modern era with MK9 in 2011, wasn't taken seriously by a lot of pro players, but it is definitely number one with a bullet now. So I'm always interested to see what each new Mortal Kombat game has in store.
Yes, who knows what is in store for this franchise in between us recording today and when it goes live. We could all look like fools, but let us be the fools who had fun talking about Mortal Kombat for hours on end. I certainly had fun tonight. I had fun revisiting these games, making the notes. I had fun revisiting these games, watching videos to remind myself, you know, which character was in which game, because, you know, it's been a long time. I had to confirm this. So I had fun tonight. Thank you so much for joining me, everybody. Stuart, why don't you go first and tell the people where they can find you on the internet?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Stuart Picabra, wittering on constantly. and also, I've got a book coming out called All Games Are Good that's going to be out at the end of June, I believe, through Press Run. And it's about how all games are good, even when they're bad. So, yeah, a huge collection of silly writings that I've done, and also serious writings that I've done about video games. Really hope people are going to enjoy it.
Thank you.
You can find me at David L. Craddock on Twitter, davidlcraddock.com on the interwebs, and check out Long Live Mortal Kombat. And Stu, that book sounds fantastic. I cannot wait to check that out.
Thank you. I've read many of your books, I have to say. I'm not going to lie, a lot of them came through a story bundle, but I have read lots and lots of them.
Well, that's awesome. I appreciate that. Thank you.
They're good reads.
Meanwhile, this has been Retronauts, and we appreciate everyone who listens to Retronauts, but we especially appreciate the fact that some of you donate your hard-earned dollars to keep this podcast on the air. So yes, if you go to patreon.com/retronauts, you can, for $3 a month, listen to all our episodes 1 week early and in higher quality audio format. However, if you go a little further, if you do $5 a month, guess what? You get the early episodes, you get exclusive episodes, 2 every month, you get exclusive weekly columns from me. I also read them, which means there are exclusive weekly podcasts. We have an exclusive monthly community podcast, usually featuring me, sometimes Stu, maybe other Retronauts, who can say? We also have Discord. The Discord is also exclusive to the $5 level, so for a small pittance each month, you can get a lot more Retronauts. But even if you listen for free, we are glad you're here. Thank you so much. In the meantime, me personally, Diamond Fight, you can find me around the internet if you look up Fight Club, F-E-I-T, that is my last name, C-L-U-B, that is a weapon that you might beat someone to death with, like a Mortal Kombat character, but perhaps in Mortal Kombat 4, which we'll talk about in the future. But for now, this has been a 2D retrospective of Mortal Kombat. Thank you so much. Finish me?
Okay, I'll get on a plane and...
Oh, ah.
Wow. That was an epic.